Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, September 10th, 2018. Time is flying. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. And if you are listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389-POUND. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the right-hand side. And just for a note for those who may be new, we provide quite a few free courses here at National Liberty Alliance. There's also a course on how to access the courts. That is the course that we took to learn a lot about how things work in the court. Of course, the perspective came from a bar taught attorney who seemed to have a pretty good grip on things to some degree. But he did focus and teach the idea that we should put statutes up instead of the Constitution, whereas maybe a statute is a little more clearer, I guess, was his position or something like that. I forget exactly. But anyway, the course is good to learn how to access the courts, how to write a paper, how to respond, and certain parts and forms of the court. And that particular course is not free. It's not our course. It's someone else's course. It was a couple of $100s, but you can get that by going to our page at nationallibertyalliance.org. And scroll down on the right-hand side, I believe we'll find it. It's in a couple of places, but I know it is on the right-hand side. It says, yeah, defend yourself, Juris Dictionary. Learn case-winning lawsuit procedure. In a single weekend, lawsuit self-help. But that's, you know, you got to be, I did do the course over a weekend. Took a lot of notes and stuff. And then the course became really a reference book to me, but I didn't really have a good grip on it for a while. It took a little more time than a weekend, but you can go through the course in a weekend. But your continued studies on what you've learned needs to continue and use, again, this book as a reference point, how to write a case. And it's really laid out pretty well, at least, you know, when I took it, it was nice. Anyway, that is available. I think it's $249, if I remember, for the course, something like that. Well worth the money for anybody who really wants to learn and get into the court. The second thing I would suggest people to do particularly is read the federal rules. Now, you don't have to read everything, but as you go through there, you'll see the important part. It kind of makes sense on things you need to have to read. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later on, about the rules of the court. And about the penal code under the federal law. And we may even talk a little bit about what's going on under the state courts and their statutes. And we're probably going to talk a little bit tonight maybe about USC 26. And again, it'll be very minimum because that's really all we need to know is very minimum on that particular case. We also... on U.S. 18, I believe it's the same case. You know, we want to open up a common law court. Statutes are not permitted, and we're going to talk more about 18 and what's going on in the courts concerning people who are put in jail. Okay, let's get to our scripture reading before we go forward. I'm not sure exactly where I left off, and I'm looking here, and I'm thinking I might have read, all the way through to at least 38 on chapter 5 of the Gospel of John. I'm going to be cautious and pick up at verse 19 and read probably to at least the end of the chapter, which is 47. And Jesus is responding. He's answering to those who... to the Jews that sought to kill him because he had broken the Sabbath and that he also said that that God was his father and therefore making himself equal with God. Well, amen. That's exactly what he did say. And then Jesus answered and said unto them, truly, truly, I say unto thee, the Son of Man do nothing of himself but what the Father what he seeth the Father do, for what things soever he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise. For the Father loveth the Son, and showeth him all things that himself doeth, and he will show him greater works than these, that ye may marvel. For as the Father raised up the dead and quickeneth them, even the Son quickeneth whom he will. For the Father judgeth no man, but hath committed all judgment unto the Son, that all men should honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. He that honoreth not the Son, honoreth not the Father, which hath sent him. Truly, truly, I say unto you, he that heareth my words and believeth on them, on him that sent me, hath everlasting life, and shall not come into condemnation, but is passed from death unto life. Truly, truly, I say unto you, the hour is coming and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. For as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself, and hath given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. Marvel not at this. For the hour is coming in which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice, and shall come forth, they that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. I can of my own self do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I seek not mine own will, but the will of the Father which hath sent me. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. There is another that beareth witness of me, and I know that the witness which he witness of me is true. He sent unto John, and he bare witness unto the truth. But I receive not testimony from man, but these things I say that ye might be saved. He was a burning and a shining light, and ye were willing for a season to rejoice in his light. But I have greater witness than that of John. For the works which the Father hath given me to finish, the same work that I do beareth witness of me, that the Father hath sent me. And the Father himself, which hath sent me, hath borne witness of me. Ye have neither heard his voice at any time, nor seen his shape. And ye have not his word abiding in you, for whom he hath sent him, ye believe not. Search the scriptures, for in them ye think that ye have eternal life, and they that which testify of me, and ye will not come to me that ye may have life. I receive not honor from men, but I know you, that ye have not the love of God in you. I am come in my Father's name, that ye receive me not. If another shall come in his own name, him ye will receive. How can ye believe which receive honor one of another, and seek not the honor that cometh from God only? Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuseth you, even Moses, in whom ye trust. For had ye believed Moses, ye would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But if ye believe not his writings, how shall ye believe my words? Okay, that's the end of the chapter. That was John chapter 5. We read from verse 19 through 47. So next week we'll pick up in John chapter 6. Okay, let's see. I'd like to talk a little bit. We did talk last week about USC 18. So it's United States Code Title 18. And what I have discovered is quite interesting, and I did bring it up last week. I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly how much I read or thought or talked about it. We had a small group of people that came last week. It was a holiday. And goodness, I think it was maybe 30 or 40, maybe about 30 of us. Most of the leadership didn't come, and they took advantage of the holiday and whatever. So we only met for an hour, hour and a half. I think we closed down at 10:30. And I think I talked a little bit then about 18, and I might have talked a little bit about 18 prior to that week. But I like to read a few things, and first look at the abuse of the court through Rule 12. And I'm going to read a few things that I put together. And, of course, some of it is quotes, and some of it is my own words, but generally speaking, it's mostly quotes. And in Rule 12, this is the abuse of the courts that abuse this particular rule, usually with pro se litigants. I have never seen or heard of any lawyer being thrown out for Rule 12, only pro ses. And there is a way that we can kind of secure ourselves from that happening. And if it did happen, you can appeal it to the appellate court. And I'm sure the appellate court will overturn that decision and bring you back into the court. One of the problems appealing is money. These people, they just don't stop. And the fact that you pay money brings us into the civil side, the statutory process, the statutory side of the court. So we have to battle that and battle our money back, try to get our money back. And we'll talk more about that as we proceed through this case that we're putting together now. And as we proceed through the New York case on the gun laws, anybody who really wants to know what's going on and really get a good picture and an understanding of the arguments and be able to make their own arguments, pretty much the argument we make, but you do it your own way, bringing up particularly the facts and the law that we have applied and brought together and are applying in the court. But first look at Rule 12, the abuse of the court. The general rule, The general rule is that a complaint should not be dismissed unless, now this is a Supreme Court ruling, by the way, United States Supreme Court, and in fact, they have to obey this, okay, unless it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim. Even if the defendant has not demanded such relief in his pleadings, every final judgment shall grant the relief to which the party in whom favor it is rendered is entitled. A complaint should not be dismissed unless it is beyond doubt that no set of facts support the claim. So this is the most important abused rule by the judiciary. It could be a good common sense rule if judges were just, but unfortunately we have not found one yet. So with a wink and a nod between the judge and the United States attorney, pro se litigants with a strong case against the deep state status quo are always booted out of the court so that our servant government does not have to answer. We the people in this case have more than met the requirements of Rule 12. Therefore, we the people nullify the use of Rule 12 in this case. Now, by the way, this is, I'm reading out of a paper that we are putting together. We've drawn some of this, of course, from some other papers that we have learned and put this in concerning Rule 12. So for some of us, it's kind of a redundant thing, but there's always something new here, and we're going to get into some new things. But being redundant with things is how we really learn. You know, after a while, over and over and over again, it sinks in. It etches into our brain the knowledge of what we're, you know, dealing with. So we have to swim in this stuff. If you really want to be good in the law and you really want to excel and you want to be able to be on top of things in the court and prevent yourself from being thrown out of the court and ultimately winning in the court, then the key thing to do is swim in this stuff. I mean, you got to really spend time, read. Read it over again. Make sure you understand it, et cetera, et cetera. And our court cases are really good things to read because we have done a lot of research to pull these things together, to put these positions together, and to understand, particularly right now we're talking about the rules. We're going to talk about U.S. 18 and U.S. 26. And these are important to know about these things because these are the things that will save you in the court. These are the things that will keep you in the court. Remember, you have to be on top of the case and go after them before they come after you. You know, you'll see the rumbling if the IRS is after you or some other government agency or something is coming after you, you know, and gnawing at you, and you know that the court case, they're building for it. Well, you got to get ahead in the game and sue them first, especially the IRS. You do not want to go into their tax courts. They are vicious. They're unconstitutional. They're evil. They're relenting and unrelenting. And they they will destroy you. And it's very difficult to get out of a tax court. So again, you want to bring your case in first if the IRS, if you're having a problem with the IRS. And you'll know because they have to warn you, at least in their regulations. And U.S. 26 is nothing but regulations. It is not law. And we're going to talk about that. But, you know, with their regulations, if they're going to come after you, they'll start with a lien. And then after the lien, they'll start. They'll work their way into the court case. Of course, they'll be sending more and more papers. So the key thing, really, to prevent that lien from coming upon you is to sue them. And if you do sue them, you're going to want to sue some local people also along with that to prevent the stealing of your money. I sued the sheriff. I sued the clerk. That prevented both of them from going forward. And to make really sure it wouldn't happen, I sued my banks. And that, in its sense, prevented them from going forward. And then, of course, filing the case immediately. So that's the way you got to do it if they're coming out after you, getting ahead of the game, to get into a court of record that you might be able to control. And again, to control that case, you're going to have to do it by understanding these rules and coming in properly. And also understanding U.S. 26 and U.S. 18. You know, whenever the government agency sends you any information, you need to look up the cases that they use to quote, and you will find, and their regulations, and you will find has nothing to do with you, absolutely nothing. And therein is the way to make your case, is to use what they're throwing at you, throw it right back at them. But again, you have to control, you have to be the plaintiff. You know, you cannot be the defendant. You must never be the defendant. Unless you can, you know, well, again, you can't be the defendant. It's not good positioning. Okay, you can always do a counter-sue if you are the defendant, then you can become the counter-complainant or defendant, I guess. Defendant is a much better word than complainant. I'm not making a complaint. I'm defending. Okay, and the other... I mean, a plaintiff, you know, you're not making a complaint, but you're coming in as plaintiff for an action at law. I'm sorry, that's what I really meant to say. Anyway, let's get back to Rule 12 abuse. So that's the general rule from the United States Supreme Court that we read. And in order to make a good case for yourself, you want to follow the rules. You know, I finished going through the rules, and Rule 12 is the only abusive rule that I really saw. There is a connection. I didn't read through when I got to the end of the civil cases that you get into maritime law. And I have to read through that. There are some dangerous things there that brings in rem into the civil court side of things. And we'll talk about that a little later, maybe. But you got to be careful of that. And I want to read a little more through that before I comment too much. Okay, so Rule 8, okay, is a key rule to look at when writing your case. Rule 8, and I'm going to read from the position of this particular case that we're writing right now, which is, again, this case we're writing right now is to sue the judiciary, so no judge, that is, and we're suing the Bar Association. We're also suing both the houses, you know, the Senate and the House of Representatives, judiciary committees, and we're also suing the United States Supreme Court. So I think that is the limit of what we're suing. There might be some others we may include, but right at this time, that's kind of the focus. And this kind of puts them in a position where none of them can sit as an arbitrator. We've got to get someone on the outside to sit as an arbitrator. Maybe a lawyer that was not bar taught, not under the bar influence. Maybe they, of course, they took the bar test to get in, but again, they were not heavily, you know, put under the influence of the bar. There are other people that could sit in as, and we'll cover that at another time. I want to do a little more homework on that, but there are other people that can sit in as a magistrate, in other words, to keep the court case going and things in order. But Rule 8, let me read this, what we have written here. This action at law is compliant with Rule 8, which states, a pleading that states a claim for the relief must contain, number one, a short and plain statement of the grounds for the court's jurisdiction, unless the court already has jurisdiction and the claim needs no new jurisdictional support. Number two, a short and plain statement of the claim, showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. And number three, a demand for the relief sought, which may include relief in the alternative or different types of relief. So that's Rule 9, I mean Rule 8, and you want to make sure that your papers comply to that rule, that you make sure you take those 3 points, throw them on a paper, and when you're writing your paper, you know, you get to that certain point, you want to make sure you cover those points. Now, Rule 9 is a very interesting rule. It provides for the pleading of special matters, whereas we the people are not, and this is important to make the statement, in my opinion, not pleading any special matters. The court is to take judicial notice that this is a court of record under the common law and not an admiralty or maritime claim under USC Title 18 that proceeds according to statutes later elaborated on within this action at law. So we want to be very, very careful to make a statement concerning Rule 9. At least I believe we should. And also cover USC Title 18. Because remember, we're going to make a position to move the jurisdiction where it belongs, as we have stated, a court of record, which proceeds under, you know, the process of the common law and not under statutes. If you don't really clear this up and make this battle with the court, because then, you know, you can move it over back into the appellate court for cause, okay, for a violation, which we probably should have done in the New York case, but I didn't realize it at the time. And we're going to probably do it as soon as we get a decision over there. As far as I know, there has not been a decision. I haven't seen anything come in the mail. So there has been no decision. I don't know if anybody has looked the case up to see. If they could, maybe they could do that and comment to see if there's any new papers in there yet. The decision, the judge said he was going to make a decision. This is on the New York case for the gun issue. The judge said he was going to make a decision on whether he was going to throw us out on a Rule 12 or not. And he was going to do that on June 19th. And we are now in September, coming up on September 19th. So that's July, August, almost 3 months. Why is he procrastinating? Well, I believe that he's procrastinating because he's in a dilemma. He's stuck between a rock and a hard place. We are going to appeal that. Now, I always have thought not to appeal anything. You know, we have to act in a different manner. But really, we have to use the process, and we have to appeal it. We can act in a different manner if we don't get the proper results. But we can appeal it, and then we can go up to the up to another appellate process if necessary. But we must make a good position on that, and we will show, you know, we're going to write one soon. I'm writing one for another case, plus we'll be writing one for the New York case if they, you know, throw us out. And we will be writing one for this other case, if it's necessary, the one that we're putting in. But anyway, Rule 9, very important, in my opinion, to focus in on US 18, because generally speaking, that is a lot of what they'll use against us. But not only that, it's the admiralty or maritime claim, which is where really we want to make sure we stay away from. Okay, Rule 10. This action at law is compliant with Rule 10, which requires a caption, which names all the parties, and B, every statement has a line number to reply to, and C, all exhibits are referenced with exhibit letters or numbers and attached. Okay, so you want to make sure that you comply with that rule, rule number 10. And let me tell you, these particular rules that you're complying to and the way that they're teaching you how to bring this paper, this form together, because that's really what they're doing, is they want to get you to make a form, a proper form that we, that all, everyone in the court uses so that, you know, that it can flow quickly and easily. It makes sense, and make sure you cover all these items because those are the key points you need to make. Okay, Rule 11. This action at law is compliant with Rule 10, which requires the signing of the pleadings. Rule 11. So Rule 11 really just tells you to make sure you have a signature on your paper. Okay. That's pretty much all I wrote at this point on that. There are no more rules that we need to be compliant to, so I need to really kind of bring this all together and make that point. If we make a case, and again, we don't have to get too elaborate. I mean, pretty much what I just read was is key, other than, of course, complying to the way things were put together, that you have to make sure that you have facts that in your case that you can prove. Usually through documents, or whatever proof that you're using that you're going to label as exhibits. So that's, I think, part of the key there. Let's see what else we have here. Okay, U.S. codes versus the law. The United States, and this is key, and again, we're putting this into our case, and so I'm kind of reading out of this, and, you know, so my, the case right now is chopped up. We have about 70 pages already. I don't know how many we're going to end up with. Some of those pages, of course, are going to be dismissed because we just got a lot of notes thrown onto this and trying to get a structure how we're going to go and lay this case out and how we may prosecute it. And remember, we're looking at this as if we're prosecuting the case because ultimately we are prosecuting the case because we're going up against all of the judiciary, all of these individuals we mentioned, and particularly focusing in on the judiciary. And we're coming in as the grand jury, and we're making the point that we are coming in on behalf of we the people. And we're going to establish how and why we're coming in, you know, by what authority we come in. We're going to lay all that out. But the United States Code versus law. The United States Code contains the general and permanent laws of the United States, arranged into 54 broad titles according to subject matter. The organization of the Code was originally established by Congress in 1926 with the enactment of the Act of June 30, 1926. Chapter 712. Since then, 27 of the titles referred to as positive law titles, positive law titles, and they have been restated and enacted into law by Congress as titles of the code. The phrase positive law literally means law established by human authority. The remaining titles, referred to as non-positive laws, titles, are made up of sections from many acts of Congress that were earlier included in the original code or subsequently added by the editors of the code, i.e. the Office of the Law Revision Council and its predecessors in the House of Representatives. Now, positive law typically consists of an enacted law, the code, statutes, and regulations that are applied and enforced in the courts. The term derives from the medieval use of positum, Latin established, so that the phrase positive law literally means law established by human authority. Black's Law Dictionary, 1200, 8th edition, 2004. Non-positive law titles have not been enacted by Congress and therefore is not law and cannot be enforced in the courts. That's very important. So we have to understand what 27 titles are of positive law. The rest of them are administrative law. They're called nisi prius courts. Nisi prius, as we've, I'm sure most of us know, is first and less, which means if you do not come in and deny the jurisdiction, then that jurisdiction will be held upon you. And, of course, they play some other games here, and they do not have the power. No nisi prius court has the power to fine or incarcerate, but they do. All of your town courts, village courts, city courts, all nisi prius courts. Some of the federal courts under certain jurisdictions are nisi prius. They don't have the power to fine or incarcerate. It's an administrative process. You have to participate in it. So the one thing you want to do is never not show up to a court if they're pulling you into a court. You do want to show up, and you're coming in, you know, under what's it called, special appearance. And when you're saying special appearance, if they want you to really define, they should know what you're talking about. Maybe they want to know if you know what you're talking about. So they'll want you to define it possibly. And basically you're here to test to see if there is something here that you need to respond. And so being there by special appearance, you can listen for a while and you can understand what their position is, what their jurisdiction is, what their authority is, and you can respond to that and deny it and say, I deny, you know, basically participation here. You have no personam jurisdiction. You don't have subject matter jurisdiction. And I have no part with this court. You're going to want to wait till the end to do this, I think, pretty much. And let the court know that you're not participating at the end. Now, the court may say something that you better come back and they set a date, so on and so forth. Well, now, the only way you can deal with that is to move that into federal court for cause. Okay? This is an Nisi Prius court. They're trying to apply their jurisdiction on you. They don't have jurisdiction. You're not getting due process in that court. You know, it's a court that doesn't give due process, and so on and so forth. And there are other things, of course, you want to make a mention of. But anyway, let's move on. So these are the cases. These are the different courts that have power or authority. And we're going to look at Title 18. I am just blown away. I think I mentioned this before, or what we discovered here. And Title 18 is not the law of the land. Title 18 is maritime and territorial jurisdiction. That's important to understand, especially if they're using this against you in a criminal matter, because inside Title 18 is the penal code. And a lot of people go to jail under Title 18 through the penal code. Chapter 1 of Title 18, this is Chapter 1 of Title 18, general positions, provisions, USC Title 18, Subsection 7, Special Maritime and Territorial Jurisdictions of the United States defined. The term Special Maritime and Territorial Jurisdiction of the United States as used in this title includes the high seas and any other waters within the admiralty and maritime jurisdiction of the United States and out of the jurisdiction of any particular state. Number two, any vessel registered, licensed, or enrolled under the laws of the United States. Number three, any lands reserved or acquired for the use of the United States. Number four, any island, rock, or key containing deposits of guano. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but ultimately this word guano, it's the excrement of seabirds used as fertilizer. So go figure that one out. In any event, that's part of their jurisdiction under Title 18. Okay. Let's see. Number five, any aircraft belonging in whole or in part to the United States. Number six, any vehicle used or designed for flight or navigation in space. Number seven, any place outside the jurisdiction of any nation. And that's an important one to realize here. Any place outside the jurisdiction of any nation. The United States is a nation. Number eight, any foreign vessel during a voyage having a scheduled departure from or an arrival in the United States. Number nine, military or other United States government missions or entities in foreign states. So that is what Title 18, that's where their jurisdiction is. So I searched through all of Title 18. There is no other speaking of any other jurisdiction. That is it. So Chapter 1 sets forth the jurisdiction. It was enacted in law, but it's maritime law. Historical and revisional notes we got here concerning what took place. Okay, this section first appeared in the 1909 Criminal Code. It made it possible to combine in one chapter all the penal provisions covering acts within the admiralty and maritime jurisdiction without the necessity of repeating in each section the place covered. In several revision sections of Chapter 11, the words "within the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States" have been added. Thus, the jurisdictional limitations will be preserved in all sections of said Chapter 11 describing an offense. So that is very important to realize, that they're not going to repeat this. You'll find in other places things are repeated over and over again for jurisdiction, or in one fashion or another. But here it said all the penal provisions covering acts within the admiralty and maritime jurisdiction without the necessity of repeating it in each section, the places that are covered. So there's no redundancy to make the point of the jurisdiction. And if there's one thing I've learned about lawyers, is that they really don't do their homework. They're horrible writers. They say the same thing over and over again. If you followed, if you could read the papers, it's the same thing over and over. They're different positions, but it's the same thing over and over again. And they'll use certain codes. They're not going to go and really study things like this, jurisdiction. They're already presumptuous. They've been taught in school that the U.S. 18 is the jurisdiction of the land, when in fact it is not. It's maritime. Cross-references laws of the state adopted for areas within federal jurisdictions. See Section 13 of this title. This section, I think I just read this, yeah. I'll read it again anyway. This section first appeared in 1909 Criminal Code. It made it possible to combine a chapter into the Penal Code covering acts within the admiralty and maritime jurisdiction without the necessity of repeating in each section places covered. USC Title 18, Subsection 5, United States defines the term United States as used in this title in a territorial sense. Includes all places and waters, continental or insular, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, except the Canal Zone. That was June 1948. All courts operating under U.S. codes are inferior courts whose jurisdictions are limited and special and whose proceedings are not according to the course of the common law. Criminal courts are courts under USC 18, whose jurisdiction and procedure is defined by the statute. Likewise, civil courts and admiralty courts proceed according to statutory law. Any court proceeding according to statutory court is not a court of record, which only proceeds according to the common law. It is an inferior court. Now, that is a U.S. Supreme Court decision also. I don't have the actual, information, the case number and name. I got to find that. But I found this that I had, and I didn't have the case reference for it, and so I got to go dig that up. I know that I have it, that I used it in another case. Okay, anyway, Title 18, positive law citation, contradicts its legislative construction statement, whereas both were enacted on the same day. Nevertheless, USC 18 jurisdiction applies to the law of the sea and not the law of the land. See the aforesaid Title 18 jurisdiction. The Act of June 25, 1948, which enacted Title 18, clearly stated that no inference, this is important, this is also repeated in U.S. 26, no inference, which means in fact not real, of a legislative construction, which means law. In other words, states, Title 18 is in fact not real law. Thus, Title 18 of the United States Code, entitled Crimes and Criminal Procedures, only define a contract with individuals within the naval, marine, and territorial jurisdiction, and is thereby an administrative process where its violations are to be heard in a nisi prius court. Therefore, the individual is to have agreed before it can proceed. But remember, nisi prius courts cannot fine or incarcerate, but they do. They do it because you are ignorant, I am ignorant. And I speak to myself first on that. But I have picked up the, you know, the decision to go forward and learn about this stuff and no longer be ignorant. Slaves are ignorant. We are ignorant slaves. And if we want to stop being a slave, we need to learn these things. You know, these are not difficult things, and everything is referenced. You know, you create your notes, and really your notes become reference points, and the books you look at and so on and so forth, you'll pick up and use as reference. We have a lot of things put together that people can use it as reference on our page. But anyway, they're kind of fascinating, interesting when you look into the common law and relate to the statutes. I would not get too deep in the statutes because, remember, they're irrelevant. They're null and void. They have no power. They have no authority. Okay. U.S. 26 has no defined jurisdiction at all. I went through that whole... There is no jurisdiction definition at all in U.S. 26. U.S. 26 is all regulations. Regulations have nothing to do with we the people. Okay? Nothing at all. And I'll be honest with you, it's so destroyed. I mean, there's like... I think I have any. How many pages? Let me see if I can find that quickly. No, I can't find it too quickly. If I recall, it's something like 8,600 and something, whatever. But it's over 8,000 pages, if I recall. I mean, 8,000 pages of just nothing but senseless things. You can't make heads or tail out of anything in it. Okay. So Title 26 has no defined jurisdiction. It is not the law of the land. And they played a good game here. Listen, Title 26, Section 1, A and B, was enacted into positive law in 1979. Now, no jurisdiction. It's not law. It's all regulations. And when you read through the regulations, you know, there is no power or authority to do anything. They use it as an administrative process, and they have all these hidden things in there that they pull up and play upon the people, and they get a conviction, people go to jail, and so on and so forth. When in fact, they really don't have the power or the authority to do it, but they do it. So let me read this again. Title 26 in Section 1A and B was enacted into positive law. So the Congress enacted it as positive law. In 1979, and then Section 1, A and B, was omitted. You go and look, and you can find this in Table 1, 1986 Code, Section 1. Therefore, U.S. 26 is not law, and if it were, it would be repugnant to the Constitution anyway. But that section is omitted. It's gone. So they enact it into law, and they'll use those statements, and then they'll go back. If you go back to the table, you'll find out it's been omitted. Title 26 has not been enacted, therefore. It is not positive law. Here it is. It's 6,496 pages of gibberish. The tax court is at best an administrative court claiming to be an Article I court, while in fact there is absolutely no constitutional authority for the creation of a tax court. There is no such thing as an Article I court. You must be participating, signing the a 1040 or other IS document to be under their jurisdiction. Never, in other words, you're participating in the administrative process. Nevertheless, administrative courts are nisi prius courts. They do not have the power to fine or incarcerate. Furthermore, all United States codes that have been enacted by Congress and are not repugnant to the Constitution is part of the law of the land within its proper jurisdiction. Okay? We've got a definition of nisi prius court. It's in Latin term, bovier lore, where courts hearing this name, where courts bearing this name exist in the United States. They are instituted by statutory provisions. Black's Fifth. Nisi prius means first. Nisi means unless. A nisi prius procedure is a procedure to which a party first agrees unless he objects. So you must go to these courts. you must make the point that you were there for special appearance, because the fact that you showed up to that court and responded when they call your name at that, just right there, your appearance gives them authority over you. You must state the point that you're there for special appearance. You know, if you're battling a traffic ticket or something like that, you know, you could practice this there. You're going to lose, but well, you may win. Who knows? Depending on what you do after that. I never go to a traffic court ever. And I just, well, I can't say ever. I do at some point. I send papers immediately and deny jurisdiction and read them some law and so on and so forth. And half the time it works, half the time it doesn't. The other half I just go in and pay the fine. It's just not worth fighting it. So anyway, a court of record proceeds according to the course of the common law. Courts of record are, and courts not of record, the former being those whose acts and judicial proceedings are enrolled or recorded for perpetual memory and testimony, and which have the power to fine or imprison for contempt. Error lies in their judgments, and they generally possess a seal. Courts not of record are those of inferior dignity, which have no power to fine or imprison, and in which the proceedings are not enrolled in record and recorded. A court of record is a superior court. A court not of record is an inferior court. Inferior courts are those whose jurisdiction is limited and special, and whose proceedings are not according to the course of the common law. Criminal courts proceed according to statutory law. Jurisdictions and procedure is defined by statutes. Likewise, civil courts and admiralty courts proceed according to the statutory law. Any court proceeding according to statutory law is not a court of record, which only proceeds according to the common law. It is an inferior court. And again, that's a U.S. Supreme Court quote. Let's see, Article 1, Section 9 clause states that no captation or other direct tax shall be laid. A direct tax is a tax directly upon you. That's a direct tax. Any tax that comes directly to you as a person is illegal. Okay? Of course, you know, items are taxed, and you go buy something and you have to pay a tax on it. That's a legal tax, obviously. And there are lots of commercial taxes that, you know, has nothing to do with we the people. Anyway, no captation or other direct tax. Remember, a direct tax is a tax that you can avoid. You can't avoid. Any legal tax you are able to avoid. If you don't want to pay the tax, you don't buy the item. You know, you can avoid the tax. Let's see. Which means no income tax ought to be placed upon we the people. The United States Supreme Court clarified this point when they said the 16th Amendment does not justify the taxation of persons or things previously immune. It was intended only to remove all occasion for any apportionment of income taxes among the states. It does not authorize a tax on a salary. Congress cannot, by any definition of income in this case, it may adopt and conclude the matter, since it cannot by legislation alter the Constitution from which alone it derives its power to legislate, and within whose limitations alone that power can be lawfully expressed. In construing federal revenue statutes, the Supreme Court gives no weight to Treasury regulations, which attempts to add to statutes something which is not there. And that's a powerful statement, and it's a couple of different, I believe this is a couple of different cases really brought together. We have Evans versus Gore. We have Eisner versus Macomba. We have the numbers also attached to this. So, again, when this goes public and we file this paper, you know, all of this information is going to be here. And again, it's going to be a very long case because there's so much to really deal with all the problems we need to overturn in order to get back to courts of record, back to common law. Let's see. Yeah, I guess I'll read a few more here before we move on or see what we do. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4 states that no captation or other direct tax shall be laid. I think this is a new... Hold on a minute. Okay, that's what I just read. The income tax system is a self-reporting and self-asserting one. It is based upon voluntary assessment and payment, not distinct. Okay, that's a U.S. Supreme Court ruling again. That particular case is Flora versus the United States. Therefore, tax courts operating under USC 26 are administrative courts, which means we the people do not have to participate, and for those who have been fraudulently intimidated into participating may also deny their jurisdiction, as per Chief Justice William Rehnquist's remarks at the rededication of the National Archives September 17, 2003, where he said, "I believe that the creation of the independent constitutional courts with the authority to declare unconstitutional laws passed by the state or federal legislators is probably the most significant single contribution the United States has made to the act of government." Judge Bork said that 85% of the people in jail for minor crimes are there because they opened their mouth. You came to court to see what was going on, and you pleaded or responded, and you didn't say, "I'm here by special appearance." And at the end of the court, the end of the procedure, which is usually short, this or that, you this and blah 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 blah. You're going to come back, you object, and you let them know, "I came here by special appearance. I don't see jurisdiction. I don't see authority." And the court will respond to that in one way or another. "Buddy, you better be here next week or next month. We'll see you on that date. You better be here." Well, now you either be there and deal with it and pay the fine, or if you're in trouble, maybe that they're calling something a felony and you may go to jail. You definitely want to move this into federal court. But you can move it to federal court for cause. Again, it costs, well, actually, it doesn't cost anything to move to federal court for cause. It's a court they're claiming they recognize in the state, so you can move it. I don't think there's any fee. There might be a fee, you know, $20, $30. I'm not knowledgeable of that, whether there is one. I don't recall. But, definitely if you have to file a federal case, it's $400. So when people are arrested under a statute, be a nisi prius court, they are arraigned, and when they're asked how they plead, they open their mouth and accept the court's jurisdiction and go to jail or pay the fine. This is unlawful imprisonment, of course, and extortion. The only laws that apply to the people are the laws of nature and of nature's God, of which we are entitled. We the people have declared in our founding documents that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. So this is a combination of a couple of Supreme Court cases. The first part, first is the Declaration of Independence. The second one is a case, a very, very important case. You must read this case. If you haven't read any cases, you got to read this case. Everyone has got to read this case. It's one of the most powerful cases. I think maybe second to, the judiciary, no, what is it, not the Judiciary Act, Marbury versus Madison. I think that was 1807, let me think about that. What year was that? That was 1802, I believe it was. But this case, where rights secured by the Constitution, okay, are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. And this case is Miranda versus Arizona. It is filled with great nuggets that you can use in cases, a lot of nuggets. Okay, U.S. Title 18 and 26 were applied upon we, the people, are null and void. Congress can make no law or rule to control the behavior of we, the people. So, 26 and 18, you really need to go look at it pretty close, look particularly for jurisdiction. You'll find there's no jurisdiction at all in 26, and you will also find that ultimately it's all regulations, and legislators are giving authority, I forget who they're giving the authority to make certain rules and regulations concerning the regulations they gave them. But again, you don't want to be a defendant in that, what they call the Article I court. And you want to be a plaintiff in a court of record. And if I was to go into an Article I court, I would move it for cause into a court of record. That's what I would do. I would move it into the federal district courts, out of the tax court. And I would challenge their jurisdiction and their authority over me in any way, subject matter, and personam jurisdiction. I would challenge both of that. I'd have to think about what else I would put in there, but that's the key.
Hey, John.
But 18 is the interesting one. Yeah, I think I'm at an end here now with this, but go ahead, Gerard.
I just want to add, I stumbled across some of this stuff from David Merlin, has been winning cases with the IRS.
Yes, that's the one you gave to me
on
the video.
Yeah, he says they're enforcing regulations and the statute doesn't apply to the people.
See, there you go, right there.
He said when they realized that the statute didn't apply to the people, they said they threw it in a different section where you would never look. And made it sound like it applied. But you see, what they do is they say your gross income is what's on your W-2. That's not your gross income because it's minus expenses. And what happens is your labor is an expense. And what happens, you don't owe tax on your labor. So you're supposed to take your salary off the top of anything you make. It's above anything you make above your salary. You're trading your labor for pay. So if you're making interest or you're buying stock and something's passively earning interest, they can tax you on that. But your labor is an expense. And what happens, he says, they skip that whole subsection 83 that determines what's taxable, and they start out and they say the whole thing is your gross income. That's a lie. And he said that's a felony. And what he does is He gives them a citizen's arrest, and he takes them to court under a criminal complaint. The judge, just like you did, he brings everybody in, and he says, "Look, I can arrest them. Citizen's arrest. And if anybody commits a felony, you have an absolute right to arrest them, and you can even use deadly force if you have to. But what he does is he brings it into a court, and he has a criminal complaint." He says, look, you can take that complaint to the sheriff, and the sheriff has to arrest him. Very interesting premise he has, and he's been winning. So it's interesting, you know?
Well, I'd be very weary about whether he's winning or not, because that's difficult to win, and there are two problems there. But one, you'd have to have a sheriff that is educated and willing with a backbone.
No sheriff has arrested any judge. What he does is he calls into question that they just committed a crime by skipping the whole section.
Yeah, but where does he bring it to, Gerard? Where does he bring the case to make these claims?
He brings it in there, and they don't answer it. He doesn't actually win as far as they quash the case. They dismiss it. It's like they did with you. They do the same thing. They drop the charges. That's winning.
All right, well, that absolutely is winning if you can lay that out and if the judge will, roll over on it.
Look what he said. They can't answer it. They can't answer, and they don't. And what they do is
I agree. If you're in that court, that might be a position to make. I could think of some other positions you could make in that court, too, particularly the things they charge against you when you look up the authorities that they claim they have. They without authority went into my bank. They, without authority, seized a small amount of money here or there. they, without authority, continue to go and do things that they have no authority over, none whatsoever. But they give you the authority that they claim, and you'll find out it all has to do with basically, ultimately, the ones that they apply to the people to come in to go into your banks. They identify you as owning a farm or something and having, fuel on it, and it's just very weird. Again, U.S. 26, if you read through that, you'll think you're in Twilight Zone. Because
it doesn't apply to us, and he said they're committing felonies. And he said all of their indictments are felonies because they don't give you an opportunity to talk to the grand jury and see who's accusing you and what the law is. So they're giving the grand jury false information by telling them that it applies to you when it doesn't. That's a felony. Right. That's a felony of the prosecutor. They're all felons because they're all, it's like RICO, they're all participating in it.
Well, if I was stuck in that court, I might use some of those positions and things and bring it into a court of record. And again, I know Bill Thornton teaches that the tax courts are courts of record. You can do this or that. No, he's wrong on that. It's a court of record only one way for them, and ultimately that gives them the authority, as Thornton says, to act as owner or fiduciary authority over you,
right,
and your assets and everything else. So that's what that's all about. That is called, it is called an Article I court. You can go onto the United States Supreme Court page and you will see that they'll have listed an Article I court. It is beyond me that they can get away with it. I challenge that. They cannot show or prove any such thing as an Article I court. It does not exist whatsoever. Only courts of law and equity can, as far as the land is concerned, can exist, and they must exist under the authority of the United States Supreme Court, which brings you right back to Article 3. Article 1, the only thing in Article 1, it states that Congress has the power to bring together the tribunals. And so the power had to be given to them in the legislative side in Article 1 in order that they can build upon it in Article 3, but it must fall underneath as Article 3 lays out. There's only such things as Article 3 courts. That's it. And so if you find yourself going in to an Article 1 court, quote-unquote, you need to challenge jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, personam
right,
jurisdiction, and also make the point that there is no due process, it is not a court of record, and you bring it over into an Article III court, which is the federal district court of wherever it is that you live. You got to bring it there, and you do it for cause. Violation of your right of due process alone is enough to bring you over there. Okay.
Well, he makes an interesting point that when you turn it into a criminal complaint, you can call it on common law then at that point.
But you have to move it into a court of justice, a common law court, someplace that has the power and the authority, because an Article I court
right,
is nothing. It's meaningless.
Well, once
but
it's
they
a,
do
once
use,
it's
they
a
do
criminal
put
complaint, it, you can, look at it. They don't have the authority to hear a criminal complaint. You sue them.
Yeah, you can hold them liable to Article to Title 18, by the way.
Right, and that's what he does. Yeah. He holds them. He turns it right around on them, everything in there. He said, look,
yeah, because they're in the federal jurisdiction.
That's right. And so he takes all those U.S. 18 and turns it and says, look, this is what you're doing. This is, he shows how they're committing RICO.
Yeah, I'll have to go a little closer to that video. I did watch a good part of it, but I got to say that I didn't watch the beginning. I went in where you told me to go in. And I don't know whether I really picked up on the end because I probably got involved in other things I was doing.
Right.
So maybe I'll find time to go through that.
Well, the first half hour, he kind of lays it out on what the scheme that they're doing against to get people into the income tax. he does a pretty good job. But then, it's an hour, and it's a long video. It's like an hour.
Yeah, well, even if you have no plans on applying that, I do know that the knowledge of that is important. And again, you know, when the IRS starts writing you letters and you don't want to respond to them, the worst thing you could do is not respond to them.
Right.
You see, by responding to them in a proper fashion concerning everything they think, do, or say, read the laws, and you'll be blown away by the laws that they're using to apply that you have to comply. You have to come down. You have to undress before us and give us everything. You know, we want to look in everywhere. We want to look into your assets, you know. We want to look into your bank statements here and there. You know, what's going on in this bank? What banks do you have? You know, all that. You don't have to comply to any of that. If you read their paperwork, you'll see it doesn't apply to you, and you respond back to them very clearly, and that this doesn't apply to you. You're not. You don't own a farm. You don't have any fuel. Because this is what I'm telling you, it's insane. This is what it says when you follow through. And they will lay it out. Maybe one day we'll do this. They will lay it out in such a way that it's all buried. They refer to this section as per that, as per this, as per the other thing.
They claim that you owe something, they've already skipped over subsection 83, which is minus expenses. They've committed a crime when they give you that. You said they take the whole thing and say it's all tax?
Right, right.
That's a crime. Because they...
They have... Look at one of the main things to stay out of there and using it in the federal court is the fact that they don't have a proof of claim. There never was a proof of claim. And they don't have the fiduciary authority over you. And that's what they're doing when they do what you say, Gerard. They're acting as if they have a claim against you. They're acting as if they have fiduciary authority over you. And they will get you. If you have put into your bank account over the course of time, let's say you're working and you're paying bills, and let's say you're making $3,000 a month, so you $12,000, $24,000, $36,000 over the course of a year, that's what went through your bank account, and you never applied anything to, you never went to deal with filing for federal, you know, taxes or any of these things, and they come out against you, they'll get access into your account, they'll find that you had $36,000 put in for the whole year, and they will evaluate your taxes as $36,000, and that's a fraud. But that's what they'll do, but they will not swear to it, they will not give a proof that you owe this, a proof of claim. We're going to give you a proof of claim, which must be filed in the federal court within your district, and you will find it not there. They do not have fiduciary authority over you, you know, to just go take your assets and do whatever they want, which is what they do, okay? They don't have the fiduciary authority, and that also has to be filed with the proof of claim. And this is your battle in court, so you have to move into the federal court. But as you're answering this, you know, the IRS, this goes back and forth because they're trying to make a case on you, all right? And by you not responding to the letters makes their case on you. You have to respond and make your case against them. All that becomes your proof. And then you have to end up with a notice and demand. Okay, that's what, and they will default on that, and in your court case you can do a show cause wherefore clause shouldn't be applied. I forget how to say that, but you know, using your wherefore clause, you're going to apply against them, you know, why this shouldn't be. Goodness, what's the words I'm looking for? Basically that they defaulted. You know, why a default shouldn't be taken. I think that's the key. And, you know, we do have paperwork on this up on our site. You can read it, go through it, and use it. But that's the key, okay? And so the wherefore, you know, all this stuff and put together with your notice and demand at some point, cease and desist, and if you don't do this or that or the other thing, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to take control over the process and decide for you and so on and so forth. And then you do. Then you file the final paper, you know, making that claim and then move it into court to show cause why a default shouldn't be taken against them. So that's one way to do it. The other thing is the last thing you want, because you'll see the drum. That's the drums being beaten. They're coming for you, you know, and it'll take time as they build up. And either you're going to go and consent to them and give them what they want and, you know, let them mug you, or you're going to move it into the court before they do. And that's the key there. But if you get into their court, you got to move it back into your court for cause.
He also shows where Pete Hendrickson went wrong with cracking the code. Uh-huh. He dissects Pete Hendrickson, what Pete did, and shows why they ended up putting him in jail. And it's kind of eye-opening because the way that he contrasted what he's doing and what Pete did and where Pete went wrong. And he said, I don't understand. He said, Pete's out of jail 6 months, and he's promoting his book again. And he says, more people have gone to jail following Pete Hendrickson's stuff.
Uh-huh.
The courts ruled against Pete, and they said all that stuff is a bunch of baloney. It's frivolous. It's this. It's that. And
we lost you there, Gerard. Unless I'm lost, let me go look to see if I'm still here online. If I can find my mouse.
I can't hear him either, John.
Okay, so I'm still here. He's the one that's gone. Thank you.
All right.
It looks like he's still on the phone. Gerard?
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. Yeah. Verizon commercial, yeah.
But anyway, it's something to look at because it's eye-opening and it fits kind of in what you're saying.
It sounds like there are things that might be able to be used for someone that's caught in a situation. You know, again, I would try. The best thing you can do is keep yourself out of that situation, and mm-hmm. and there's only one way to do it, and that is, you know, to really take it into the court, but before they do, number one. But also, you must answer every letter they send you. That is they're building a case against you using those letters. If you notice, they're numbered, and take this number, then the next number. It's a process, and so they're building a case, and you need to respond to every one of those to build your case, and that's extremely important, and that's your evidence you're going to bring into court. It's a good part of it, not all of it, but it's a good part of it. Okay. All right,
okay.
Let me move on from here.
Yep.
Let me see what we got here. What's next? Okay. We're still pushing forward for, you know, campaign for constitutional sheriffs, and, you know, we need some money on that. So anybody that can, you know, give for that, if you haven't given, you know, at least $5. But look, people need to be given $50 or $100 if they can. So those who can, please do, because we're not going to get 7,000 people to give. We've been trying to do that for a long time, and it's just not going to happen. You know, if 7,000 people were to give $5 a piece, okay, 7,000 times 5, okay, $35,000. That's a lot of money. Just think what we could do with $35,000. After 2 months, we could purchase all of the sheriff's books and mail them out, okay? Everybody was given $5 a month. But they don't. So people need to help out to give 50 or 100 or whatever they can for the cause, for the sheriff's book. Also, we're still collecting for Gerard and his situation there with the fire. So we sent out emails. I think I'm going to send out another email today. I haven't sent one out in about 4 days, but I'll send out another one. And let me tell you, look, if anybody, any of our members were to fall into a situation like that where they lost their home or their business like that to, you know, whatever, a natural event or something, you know, we here, if you brought it to our attention, we would do our best to push our membership to give to that individual, whomever they may be, that's a member of us. Even if someone found out about us and, you know, and heard what I'm saying now, and they joined us for that opportunity to be, we'll do that for them, because that's the right, that's the Christian thing to do. You know, we need to be helping each other in times of trouble. And, you know, you go back early on, and maybe even still today out in the farm country, I don't know, but, you know, going early on, you know, if someone's barn burned down or the house burned down, you know, all the farmers would come together and work together to rebuild that barn, to rebuild that house, to get that person back up, because that's the Christian thing to do. That's our real insurance, far better than the insurances that we could put bucks into every month, you know, and get some money for bad situations. But the best insurance is people insurance, friends and family, local people. So anyway, I'm going to put a message out to our, you know, our membership again. And I'm going to talk about the fact that, you know, they're a member of National Liberty Alliance, and we would assist them if they should fall into that problem. Therefore, you need to give. If you haven't given, give.
Well, that being said,
yeah,
I want to thank everybody who did give, because there was a response, and you know, throughout the membership, and we've raised some money over the past 2 weeks. I think it's like $9,700. I might be able to get my roof on. I got a tarp up there. I'm starting to clean up stuff, so I don't feel like I'm completely.
And we have two people who have given, you know, $5,000 apiece.
Right.
You know, for the sheriff's thing, which, you know, I've been so busy, I haven't been able to write a thank you letter for them, but I will be writing one, and maybe tomorrow if I get the time, I'll do it. And but also that person, one of those people, also sent a check for $1,200, which I have in my presence. I got to get it out to you. I'll try to mail it out to you tomorrow your situation. And we got a few other checks, and we got someone who gave $100 who heard about it just locally here, and we got another check for $20, and there may be another check floating around. I'm not sure. I have to dig through all these papers, but that's what, you know, more money that has come in. So you're over the 10,000 mark and close to the 11,000 maybe. And, you know, it's getting closer and closer to get to a point to get maybe the top walk, you know, the top floor on, and possibly get the roof on this year.
Right.
And again, you know, in Gerard's case, there's lots of people who are volunteering to help on that matter. So the labor should be free. We got to pay for materials, and that's great. But there's still a lot more that's needed here to replace tools and equipment and computers and so on. You lost that hand computer that cost $6,000.
Oh yeah, I lost my Snap-on. Yeah, my scanner.
That was very expensive. You lost two lifts by God's. What was that lift that came? Was that one that you stored and didn't realize, or someone else had stored?
God works in strange ways. I the week before the fire, a friend of mine who owns a shop, he acquired this lift like 4 years ago. They bought it for some kind of a event, and they only used it once and took it down, and he got a hold of it, and he's been on his trailer for 4 or 5 years. And somebody, he sells cars, and he's a body man. He does different things, and he also does race car tires during racing season. So somebody showed up at his lot, and they wanted the trailer that the lift was stored on, and they talked him into selling him the trailer to him. So now he's got this lift, and he shoves it into his box truck that he loads tires up for the races. And he's like, I got it. And the races started this week. So he's driving around with this lift in his box truck going, what am I going to do with this lift? What am I going to do with this lift? He said, I thought about putting it out back on a slab, but, you know, winter's coming, and that's a lot of work and blah, blah. So that week my shop burned down. And so we were all cleaning up, and we had a bunch of people that showed up. You know, I'm in the fire department, so I got a pretty good response on people, and we had the one half of the shop cleaned out. And he, next thing I know, he's backing up to the door. He says, "I got something for you, and you can't say no." He shoves the lift out, and then he proceeds to install it for 2 days. So I got a burned out garage with a brand new lift standing there. But we got it running, and I got a generator. I have no electric. I mean, everything was destroyed so bad. I can't believe the job that the fire did. It was ridiculous and amazing. You know, I had tools in a toolbox, and I got these rubber bats, and they boiled and melted into the tool so that you can't even. It's like looking for fossils getting those tools out. You know, hours and hours. I don't even know if it's worth it. But anyway. Nevertheless, I got a lift up and running, and thank God the inspection machine was in a section of the garage that didn't burn too bad, and just the water damage, I was able to get that running because that inspection license now in New York is like a taxi cab medallion, and that makes my business, you know, with the inspection license on it, that makes it worth more because they're paying big bucks for inspection licenses. So, you know, and that's what my customers want. They
and
want
that would be helpful inspection. In your retirement, you know?
Absolutely.
Being able to sell that,
so, you
know?
You know, amongst the disaster, there was many miracles, John. I can honestly say I see the finger of God in there working. And, I mean, if I didn't have faith, I would be depressed. I don't know what I would do because it's such a big task getting back. You know, as you're pulling that stuff out and you're seeing all these things it took you 40 years to buy, and there's no way I'm going to replace all of it. But, you know, I can't do everything like I used to anyway. I'm going to have to change the nature of my business somewhat. And maybe that's the finger of God here too, telling me that I got to relax a little more and, you know, and sort of pick and choose what I want to do now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I just hope that I can get something done before the cold weather comes because it is my only source of income. And, you know, I'm going to have to be out there working. No, I have no choice. You know, I have to do it, whether I got, you know, a salamander
right.
heater
so,
or whatever.
So we got to get that building closed in. Tops won't really do well. We need to, you know, you got three, let's see, you got one, well, you got all the exterior walls that are still good because they were blocking. You got a big interior wall, and they're like 24 feet apart, so it's like two 24-foot spans for your garage where you have, you're going to have three lips in. And, so if we can get that knee wall up on the one wall to make it even and then run at least the floor trusses for the top attic or floor space and get that covered up and maybe at worst case get get that insulated and also get a housetop at least for the winter and then maybe finish off in the spring with the trusses, you know, we're not going to do trusses, we're going to do rafters with the rafters. And, you know, so we got a lot of work to do there, and we got to get it done. We need enough money to get it done before the winter comes in, as Gerard said, and we got to get three or four garage doors. I think two on the front.
Yeah, I got three 12-13-foot doors.
Yeah, they got to be so big, so
yeah,
we
got
to get them in, and you know, are all those blocks filled with concrete all the way through?
No.
We're just in the corners.
Different sections.
Yeah, usually the corners. And that's okay. That's better. And I'll tell you why, because we can fill it with insulation. It'll be much, much better, you know, more insulated. So all that reservoir, we can fill that with insulation, get to the ceiling, you know, the floor joists up, like I said, and cover it up for the winter at least. Or maybe get the roof up before the winter sets in if we have enough money to buy those materials. Once we get closed in, then we got to work on electrical and heating to get things going. And, you know, did you get any electric there yet? Back up or no?
I got an electrician
that offered.
He put the box in, but it needs to be inspected and it needs a little bit more work. He's going to put me a couple plugs under the box so I have juice there to work on the shop, you know. So he did put the big panel in, and he's got to put – the riser got damaged, so he has to run new wire up the pole. He's coming back to do that this week. I'll tell you, this cold, rainy weather really got me to me. It got me a little worried about winter. It turned
I'm
cold right
you.
Away.
Yeah.
Like, holy mackerel.
I don't know what the heck's going on. The weather's crazy.
Well – you know, this, in New York, anything can happen.
Yeah.
I hate to see snow in October. Makes the winter long. But anyway, I appreciate everything that everybody has already given. There has been a pretty good response locally and even through National Liberty Alliance. You know, the people that have given have been very generous, and I appreciate that. And look at even the small things. I got lots of people giving, you know, $5, $10, and $20, and it adds up. You know, it really does.
Right. Right.
So
all
thank
right,
you
well,
very
again,
much.
I'm going to put out another call, and maybe we'll put out more calls, but we're going to put another call out maybe tomorrow, And basically, I'm going to say what I said here tonight, that, you know, if you were in trouble and you're a member, we will take care of you because we will seek our membership to get a, you know, everybody to throw in money. And again, look, at if we all really, you know, responded to this, we none of us would have to give any more than $5. None of us. Just think, $5 is $35,000. Okay? Well, in this case, you know, Gerard needs at least $70,000. I know he's got 60,000 up there, so if everybody gave 10 bucks, it would be 70,000. And with the free labor combined with that and some of the other things, then he could be back up and running. So we really need to push this hard. So anybody that hasn't given, please give. And remember, you know, if this was to befall upon you, we will be here for you also. So that's the message I'm going to get out, and hopefully we'll get more people giving, you know. And the same thing with the sheriff's thing. You know, look at the benefit of this is the common law in your county to educate your sheriff. That's what it's all about, to educate all of our sheriffs. And to make, and you know, even what we have up there so far in the sheriff's book, we're going to put more in there because we've discovered some new things that we need to put in there. But not only that, I think we need to put a couple of paragraphs in there concerning the fact that sheriffs need to be collected themselves. They need to get together, you know, county to county, and support each other, you know. And we need to push all these sheriff's associations to really do something worthwhile because clearly they're not educating the sheriffs. They have no educational things for the sheriffs. So they're really not... really doing a lot for the sheriffs as far as what their duties are. They still don't know. They don't understand the law. They don't understand what common law is. And they're confused. But if we can give them knowledge, that will give them a backbone. And you get 2, 3, 4, 5 sheriffs county to county, even if they're out-of-state sheriffs, but you get, you know, a half a dozen sheriffs or more coming together to deal with any problem, like a federal agency coming in to give them a hard time, those sheriffs have power because, you know, there's power in numbers. United we stand and divided we shall fall. And they have divided us. And our sheriffs really are still somewhat divided. I know in New York, though, there's kind of a movement for the sheriffs, but they still lack knowledge. They lack it. All right, let's move on.
Yeah, and you got a governor that tells them he can fire them if they don't do his will. I mean,
yeah,
it's
amazing.
He's
huh?
always trying to intimidate them. You know, they really got to get together and stand up. Cuomo is evil, and he calls the state police his private police force. Well, they are. He's just telling the truth. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So this is a particular problem. They need to be educated that he.
Well,
doesn't
what
have
he
that
has
power.
Done, what he has done, is raised up the sheriffs. Both of the sheriffs have come up against him. I know my sheriff is leading the pack here, and he's really angry with the governor here, and he's letting them know, you know, he doesn't have the power and the authority, and you can't get the records, and we're not giving our computers. You know, because they want to get the computers or the records in those computers of all the people who have guns here in New York, and they want that from every county. You know, and the sheriffs came together on that here in New York and said no. So that's power. That's a backbone. The governor has no ability to go up against all those sheriffs. He might be able to take out one and get away with it, but if you bring a half a dozen or more, and we've got something like 50 of them, you bring them together, there's no way, even just a half a dozen, there's no way the governor would be able to take out these sheriffs as far as their duties are you know, required.
But they have to know they have to know the Constitution. They have to know what their duties
that's
are.
A big problem.
I see them enforcing illegal warrants all the time, only because they don't know how to read them. They don't know what a warrant's supposed to look like or what the procedure is, and that's a shame. That's a real shame because they're our last stopgap, you know, between the people and the government, and so we really, really need to educate them. It's really important. And empower them. It's empowerment. Thank you.
Sheriffs need to notify the feds that don't come into my county without letting me know. And when they come in, they need to produce the warrant, okay, that they want to execute. And if they want to come in with a SWAT team on an individual they claim owes money for the IRS, the sheriff's got to tell them to go to hell to begin with. Number one, he'll find an unsworn warrant because there'll be no complaint with it, and he'll be able to kick him out for that purpose anyway. But anytime they come in with these SWAT teams, it's all about intimidations. And these people, and anybody they're coming in for, they're not hardened criminals. It's rare that really the feds are coming in for hardened criminals. They're coming in for we, the people, with this unconstitutional USC 418, which is no law at all. And the sheriff needs to stop the nonsense, you know, prevent the breakdown of doors by SWAT teams and so on, and going in the middle of the night.
The sad thing is a lot of times they do go to the sheriff and he goes with them because he's uneducated.
That shows you his lack of knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, they don't always not tell the sheriff. They do it, but like I said, they're not educated. They don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, sheriffs need to let them know. Don't come into my county without telling me, and I want to see the warrant signed with sworn affidavits. You don't got it, you ain't coming in doing nothing. Period. There is not an IRS warrant anywhere in the United States that's valid. And if sheriffs were educated, there would be no execution of IRS problems. Just wouldn't exist. Okay, because, you know, again, you know, in order to give a notice of lien to the county, well, what does that mean, the sheriff should say? I don't know what that means. Where's the warrant? Where's the authorities, you know?
Right.
Well, they need to be filed in the federal court. It's called, you know, they need to file proof of claim and the fiduciary authority. If it's not there, they have nothing. And that's the sworn statements to begin with. Then they need the judge. And again, you know, the tax court judge have no power or authority to do anything. It's a nisi prius court. So, but they don't know this. And we're just learning it, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. Just a real quickie, you know, our rough estimate for constitutional sheriff's program is to buy 100,000 booklets, which we're thinking is going to cost us literally 35 cents a piece. Okay, so that's $35,000. And mailing it to 2,100 sheriffs, each of them 20 handbooks, which is 20 ounces through media mail, is about $650. You know, sometimes it'll be $550, sometimes $650, and somewhere in between there, but we'll figure on the $650 because we'll be mailing more to some of them anyway. So $650 each, so that's another $20,150 for a total of $55,000. So, you know, that this is one of our most important projects here, especially as we're moving forward in the courts with this case against the judiciary. Jen, good to see you back. Any announcements, any questions?
Yes, I have some comments, too. I've been getting a number of comments and questions on Gerard's funding. One person went to the GoFundMe site and that wouldn't accept his donation, and I'm not sure what to tell him except to try again. Another person wanted to know if you could use PayPal.
That was on the mail at nationallibertyalliance.org. Did that come through that way?
Right. Yep.
Yeah, because when that comes to me, too, and I did respond to every one of those people and, you know, let them know that they can mail that to here, National Liberty Alliance, and we'd get it to Gerard, which really, you know, I've changed that now. Gerard's given me his address, so... Really, anybody that falls into that, we'll just give them Gerard's address, and they can just mail it directly to them.
Okay.
And I'll make sure you get, or Gerard or myself will make sure you get his address so you can respond to these things, too. One of the things they ask for, if you go through the GoFundMe, and they set it up for 15%. So if you donate in $100, they want $115. Okay, and what people need to know is you could do the drop-down box and get down to the minimum, which is 10%. So you could say, I'll give you 10% instead of 15. So it's $110 instead of $100. But if you don't want to pay that fee for the GoFundMe, you know, again, you can send it, mail it to, you know, actually right now, I'll get an address maybe up online with this and we refer to a page. But you can send it if at this point to National Liberty Alliance's address, which you find on the donation page, and just make the checks or money orders out to Gerard Apria. Go ahead. What else we got?
Yeah, another thing, some people are responding and they've already donated, so maybe if you could put a little sentence in the beginning saying that the email is intended for those who have not contributed yet.
Well, I thought
otherwise,
I was very
careful everybody
to do
thinks
that.
They're being good up again.
I thought I was very careful to do that, and
okay.
You know, because when I did send out, I said to those who haven't given already, you know, and I guess people are missing
okay.
that. I do know, I go into Home Depot all the time, and there's this little thing saying, you know, press or red or whatever it is for credit, and every time I go in there, I ask, you know, which one do I do for credit, because in Stop and Shop, it's green, in there, it's red. But now I got it. Even though the sign is there, you kind of miss it. Same thing in the post office. They have a little sign right on the machine, press red for credit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that email is probably the same thing. People are just missing it, you know. We're only
right.
asking for the people who haven't given yet.
Right.
But
okay,
we'll continue to
question,
do it the right way. Hopefully they'll see it.
Okay. It says, I have a possession case that I contracted with Chesterfield County, Virginia, outside Richmond. I know the bond amounts for the judge, prosecutor, commissioner, sheriff, policeman, county clerk, treasurer, and police chief. I have sent off my appeal back in July 15, 2018. The circuit court clerk did advise me it takes them 90 days to send it off to Richmond Supreme Court. I'm pro se. My constitutional lawyer has given me so much knowledge, but he resides in Houston. How do I get my remedy for all these damages, violation of rights, and unconstitutional acts imposed upon me? I want moral turpitude to be honored and the omission they have given into justified on my behalf. These courts are in default.
Okay, so I presume when he says possession case, he's talking about drugs. Is that what he's talking about? Do you know?
Yes, unless it was spirit entities, it would have to be drugs.
Yeah. So, you know, look, it is a problem. You know, I would battle the case if it's a, is it a federal case or state?
It doesn't sound like it because he's in Chesterfield County, Virginia. It sounds like local administrative court.
State, yeah. That's even harder to deal with, you know. I was looking to see in, for instance, New York State law to see if they would give a different jurisdiction other than the jurisdiction of the land. But they are so dumb. These legislators in New York State are so stupid and pathetic that they actually wrote this stuff as law without even protecting themselves with the fact that it's not real law at all, okay? Because they don't know. They think that they can, we're subjects to them. Matter of fact, I read in New York State laws that the citizens are subject to the state. I mean, what is that? We're not subject to the state. Well, who made them king? What are they talking about? We're not subject to the state. And yet, you know, they get away with it, and then they write all this law. So that's the problem with fighting. You know, you got to battle jurisdiction. The only way you're going to beat this is really move it into the federal court for cause. Lack of, they're not giving you due process. You're not in a common law court. You're in a statutory court under whatever the statutes are in your state. And so you're not getting due process. They don't have jurisdiction over you. They don't have personam jurisdiction. They don't have subject matter jurisdiction over you. All these statutes are null and void, blah, 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 and you need to bring it into the federal courts. But anybody that does that, if you're going to go in there with the man on the land stuff and do all this crazy stuff and clicking your heels thinking you're going to be taken out of, go back to Kansas or something, it's not going to happen. You really fight this case on real issues using the Constitution and using due process and all the things I mentioned. And that's the only way you're going to win. So you have to move it into federal court for cause. Once they use statutes, it's not a statutory court. Now, here's the other problem, okay? You have to move it into a common law court and not a civil court, right? A common law court. No statutes apply. And that's another problem. Maybe in some districts that could be easy. But I'll tell you what, none of the districts in New York that we've dealt with, it's easy. And that's the battle we're fighting. And that's the battle we need to win. And when we win that battle, everything opens up for us, because then we take control of the state problems. You know, we can then hammer down on them using the justice system to hammer down on them. Also, we can develop the plan that we have, which is getting administrators, four people acting as administrators for the juries, which are non-political, not connected to the state in any way. The state will fund it, but they'll not be owing any allegiance to the state. They're not employed by the state or anything. Totally free. Okay? And until we have that, we will never, ever, ever have free juries. We may get one here or there, but they will not last. And they will always be abused. And they will be abused in every federal district court right now as we speak, because they all are under the application of the jurist handbook that they've given them. And that is just nothing but a real abortion, let me tell you. But in any event, that's what we have to beat. We have to get rid of that handbook, put in a real handbook, jurist handbook. We have to win the court case, and then we have to start working on administrators. And people need to be educated for that position. And anybody interested in that position in your neighborhood, you know, it'll be a professional job that pays good money. But you have to become educated. You need four people in every county that are educated. And they will administer to the juries, the grand juries, the trial juries. They will be also the investigative a group or people for the grand jury. Also, they can empower the grand jury if they want to go out and look at things. Why not? This is we own it. This is our government. You know, if you want to go look into an office just to make sure that they're not breaking the law, well, you can't. And, you know, that's the power of the people. And we have a U.S. Supreme Court, United States versus Williams, that also says so. That's the power of the people, and that's the only, and that's how we get government by consent. We're consenting to the things that they're doing. So, anyway,
I just want to say, in the local courts, they don't even follow their own statutes most of the time. My son got out of a ticket because they didn't give him a preliminary hearing in enough time, and that's a violation. They have so many days after they cite you to give you a preliminary hearing, and then they have to go in front of a grand jury. And sometimes they don't even do that. So if you know what they're supposed to do, when they are, and you hold their feet to the fire, a lot of times the judges, especially if you write a good paper, they'll throw the case out for that if you insist. You say, no, you're violating my due process. I didn't get my hearing. That's grounds for dismissal. And you stick to your guns. And that judge, it gives him a hat, some place to hang his hat, and he'll dismiss the case. I've seen it happen on a couple occasions where people knew what the due process was, that the Nisi Prius courts, they're not following their own, you know, statutory due process against the people, because they're lazy and they're arrogant. And so if you know that stuff and you see that they haven't given you a hearing, or they haven't put it in front of a grand jury, look at, they're in violation. They only have so much time to do that. So, but of course, you got to know a little bit about the law in order to hold their feet to that. But I've seen that work too, and that's an easy way to get out of it, because a lot of times the judge wants a way out of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, just saying.
Well, here in New York, also they refer here to the statutes, and when they talk about rights, they call them civil rights. That means statutory rights, by the way. And they refer to the 13th Amendment, is it, or something? No, the 14th Amendment. They refer to the 14th Amendment. Okay. And why do they do that? You know? Why do they refer to the 14th Amendment? You know? So, in any event, that's where your civil rights start, I guess. They get this game of words, which really have no power anyway. But they feel comfortable with that game of words, and that house of words of fake words are going to collapse soon, you know, soon. Anyway, there's no simple answer to that question. The answer really is, the only answer is to move it into federal courts, but you better really study and understand what you're doing in order to do that. Next question.
Okay, this is part two of that question. I was also thrown in contempt at my probable cause hearing on the subject matter as well. Last thing, is it to let me put in a promissory note, being I was held in contempt for 10 days on the subject matter? The judge wasn't honoring me, stating my status, and they put me in contempt when I said, when you are finished with everyone, we can talk. Because I was sent to my seat, and when I didn't agree to that dead man's name in all cap letters, please help.
Okay, again, you know, the dead man thing, the cap letters, all that is just going to upset everybody. It doesn't help in any way. You got to get out of that thinking. You got to get away from it. It's destructive. Look, it's good to have the knowledge to understand the game they're playing for them to feel comfortable. But when you bring it up to them, they're just going to hammer down on you more. And it doesn't get you anywhere. It's not going to buy you nothing. People are teaching this stuff, and people are thinking that they're going to walk in court, say a few magic words, click their heels, and go back to Kansas. It's not going to happen. Stop it. You got to get into the law. And the law is the Constitution, the law of the land. Look at the Bill of Rights. Look at the Constitution. Look into common law. Understand the principles of the common law, and apply it, because it's you have an unalienable right to a common law court, which you're not in, by the way. You have been jailed. You were really, when you went to jail, they hijacked you, and you were kidnapped, actually, and you can bring those kidnapping charges using their codes, U.S. 42 and 18, on them. And so you were kidnapped and put into some confined place for 10 days. Because they're a statutory court, that makes them administrative. They do not, that's a nisi prius court. They do not have the power to fine or incarcerate. That you need to bring into the federal court to prosecute. And you have to prosecute it. And you have to make your demands, a well-written wherefore clause. You have to understand the structure and the form, and you got to understand the rules. And, you know, read through the rules very carefully, and you'll start to see areas you don't need to read. But, you know, there's certain rules you got to read. You know, the first, I'd say 12 particularly, you got to focus in on, because it really tells you a lot about the form and the requirement, the necessary, the flow of paper that you're going to file. But there are other rules that are important, too. You know, and at the end of that, there's a lot of forms, and as the process goes on, you'll use those forms. You can rewrite them in your own words, but you use the forms. Participate in the process in a proper rules and the forms. There's nothing wrong with that, okay? But use the Constitution. Use some good U.S. Supreme Court rulings. Make it clear. You know, a lot of these rulings that you'll find in Black's Law Dictionary. You look up words, and you'll find the meaning of words, and in the meaning of words, you'll find U.S. Supreme Court rulings. Use them as footnotes. Make the point, but make the point that you're using them not as a common law process that they would do by using, you know, federal district court rulings. No, that's not what you're doing. You're really applying this for the meaning of words, okay? For the meaning of words. But they'll quote cases that aren't even appellate court cases, and it's ridiculous on some of the things that they quote. It doesn't mean anything, you know? It's a court out of control to begin with. But in any event, look, you got to use the proper language and process. But you can use the words that come out of the Constitution and the common law. That's where you got to go. Now, again, that person has been assaulted. I'm sure they're aware of the U.S. 42 and U.S. 18, the particular subsections that apply for being kidnapped, okay? Because that, and remember, that applies to them. That's lawful, okay? That you could bring into the court. You know, so you can use statutes against them because those statutes are made to control them from abusing their power, and that can be applied to them because of the position they're holding. They've taken sworn statements themselves to obey the Constitution, and they violated that, and therefore it could be applied to them. So that's what you got to do, and if but you got to get rid of the language of the man on the land stuff. Come down into the court and get into the Constitution. Use the lawful statutes. Remember, there are 54 different U.S. Codes titles, most of them are lawful. Some of them are administrative and meant to be administrative, and that's okay if people participate in the administrative process. Look, if you're an employer and you participate with the unemployment thing, you're in the game. Now you're going to be held to the rules of that process at an administrative level. So if you signed up to that and then tried to back out once you've signed up, and reject in the courts, the administrative courts, the rulings of that administrative court, yeah, you can appeal it to the state Supreme Court, but the same state Supreme Court is going to back up the administrative court's rulings unless they were too harsh and wrong or violated your constitutional or unalienable rights that's protected by the Constitution. Unless they've done something like that, they could, overturn something. But generally, they're gonna agree with them. Okay, because you agreed to participate. So that's the kind of things with these U.S. Titles. And, people agree to certain things, and we've given them a power and authority, and 27 of them is positive law. They can use it as positive law, and rightly so. So, we don't reject all statutes. We have to come and understand that there's lots of statutes that are lawful, because we've given them the power and the authority to write those statutes. All right, anyway, they really need to come to National Liberty Alliance, read our papers, get educated, see how we put our papers together. Maybe if they probably need the law course, maybe they could take that jurisdictionary. You can find that on the right-hand side of our website. They should take our constitutional course and our civics course, and the new course eventually that will get out there will really, we got so much paperwork we need to do, but everything we're writing really is going to become part of that course one way or another anyway. It's going to be incorporated. So we are kind of continuing writing, but we just haven't got it together yet. All right, anything else?
Yes, John, do you have an opinion on the speech given by John Bolton at the Federalist Society concerning U.S. withdrawal of consent with the ICC court at The Hague, especially in light of the
right.
fact
that...
Oh, I'm
right. I just watched that speech today. I was blown away by it. I agree with John Bolton. He's absolutely correct. We've made that position. Many have tried us to bring us into that court, saying that's where you got to go. No, there's no way. Has nothing to do with we the people, has nothing to do with the Constitution, has nothing to do with common law per se, the way we have it and we understand it, has nothing to do with American jurisprudence. And so I agree 150% with what John Bolton had to say. It was great.
Okay, next question.
Anything else?
Yes, this one is a little bit long. I'll try and shrink it. This person is fighting a smart meter case. In June 13th of 18, one of their buildings had a meter exchanged against their persistent refusal from the beginning. So right after that, they sent out their notices of liability. 15 days later, after no response, they sent out their notices of fault. And again, after no response, another 15 days, they sent out their notices of default. The only response they received was a brief letter stating that all of the previously sent legitimate notarized documents were not legal nullity, and that they, the utility company, thought that it ended there. Since then, the workers from the utility company visit their property, and after kindly approaching them and quoting their activities, they stated that they were there to read our meter, and that's one thing that is supposed to be not done after they put in a smart meter. We found this ironically strange because over the years, with the original analog meters we had, We never noticed anyone reading our meter directly. On Thursday, August 30th, another utility company worker was in our driveway, and again we approached her and questioned. This was somewhat different than the last time, and her response was that she was going to exchange the meeting on our other building. We refused, and she mentioned about a potential power disconnection to our address. When we brought up about the law in our state, which is Pennsylvania Act 129, being unconstitutional, she was unaware of what the law entailed. All in all, we had a good rational conversation, and she left more aware of the big picture. She did say that she would tell her supervisors about our concern for the lack of response to our letters, and would be getting back to us shortly. Now, and they have not at this point, so this is just kind of a status. I don't know if you want to comment on it with the default letters and so
on. You know, a couple of things. You have to do affidavits on all these things. Even if you don't give it to anyone, you need to collect them and you need to write them as they're fresh in your mind, and continue to write affidavits. Even if you take good notes and then at the end write a very good affidavit. But you have to remember the conversations. Also, maybe if you have a recorder in all but just a couple of states, and I'm not sure what those couple of states are. I think Virginia is one. You know, but there's a couple of states that it's illegal to, they claim it's illegal to record a conversation. But here in New York and most states of this union, like I think 47 or 48 of them, you know, most of them, allow a person, you know, agree with a person, you know, recording a conversation as long as they are part of the conversation. You know, if you're not part of the conversation, you're out recording people, and something you're not a part, that's illegal. And I would say that would be illegal also under common law, in my opinion. But in any event, you can record. I know in New York you can record. People should check before they do it to their state. I even record in courts, okay, and there's ways to get around that and get, I'm not even talk how, but just I record in courts, and I record everywhere. And all my phone calls recorded, everything. And at any given time, I can just collect that information, and I can make one heck of a affidavit. I don't usually reveal the recordings, generally speaking, although I have in the past. I've revealed recordings at places where, you know, I was representing contractors, and the other side lied in an administrative process. Where we had disagreement on a an issue with the owners or whatever, or the other contractors, and you go before the architect or the engineer, and they act as the arbitrator, which is good. It works out very well because they understand what's going on. They can make real good decisions. And if you're really in the right, you should know it and be able to win it. But I've had recordings where I've used the recordings where people said one thing and click on the recording to show that they didn't say that one thing. They said the other thing. But affidavits work, particularly in court, very well, and you need to collect affidavits as you go along. That's number one. Number two, you got to get to that point, and you got to cover all the points. You know, I really haven't gotten too far involved in it. Gerard's got more involved in the process than I did. But you got to make sure at some point, if not in the beginning, you really got to cover the 8 points of the notice and demand. I believe it's 8 points. But there's so many points of notice and demand that you must cover, okay? And at the end, you got to let them know, well, if you're not going to do this or that or the other thing, I'm going to decide for you, you know? And that's your kind of your final paper with your notice and demand. And then you can have these all affidavits together. And if they don't respond to that in the given amount of time, you then can open a court of record in your local state court, okay? Here in New York, we call it the state Supreme Court. Every county has one. And so you can open your court of record, and you could do a show cause. Show cause why a judgment shouldn't be taken against them. Because they have defaulted already, and you want to work in court to get a default in the court, so you have to have a good wherefore clause, you have to have your notice and demand, you have to have all of the notices you've given over a period of time, you have to have all of your you know, your sworn affidavits concerning conversations with the meter people or with anybody or with the people in the office and so on and so forth, because all of that is your evidence. And so you create them into exhibits, you know, and you bring them into the court, and you do a default, and see where that goes. You should be able to win that, and you can force them off. You can hit them with a penalty, so that's what you can do. Gerard, can you add to this? Because you're more knowledgeable of this process that has been set up than I am. Gerard, where are you?
You're talking about the electric meters?
Yeah, yeah. If there's anything you want to add to this, what I just... I don't know, were you here to hear all this?
I heard most of it. Yeah, look, In power movement, he has a pretty good notice of liability.
Yeah, it sounds like he's using that. It sounds like this guy's using that. So.
Yeah, and that usually works pretty good, because he runs through everything. All that stuff you said is in there. If you follow his procedure, I mean, he gets real involved because he sends notice after notice. He really nails it down so they can't deny, you know what I mean?
Does he end up with a good notice and demand, though, or is the whole thing a notice and demand? I mean, what would exactly...
Yeah, he gives a pretty good notice and demand. The only thing is he hasn't actually gone into court to enforce the default. That's what he wants to do.
Right, and that's done by, you know, again, using the notice and demand 8 points and then moving it into the court for default, or show cause why a default shouldn't take against them.
Right, and he's sending it to the individual person. In other words, to some of the higher-ups that are in there. It's a personal notice of liability because they are attacking you personally. And don't forget, that's contract law. You know, when you're under a contract now, when they decide to change that meter, they're trying to change the contract. It's negotiable. They're telling people that if you don't change it, we're bringing the cops up and making you change it. This is a civil matter, and it's contract law. I don't know where they think they can get away with that. You know, as long as it's under this. Look, you can cross anything out on a contract, and if they don't allow that, then what happens is that's more of an adhesion contract.
Yeah, they're saying that there's no negotiation permitted, and that you can't have a contract,
it's not a
one-way
contract.
Yeah.
The fact that you're, look, at that, when, if you say to them, well, I didn't sign a contract with you, well, the fact that you paid the bill and you didn't protest it means you're under contract by your actions. So, okay, so we have an existing contract. Now you want to change it, and now I'm not agreeing to it. And they have to negotiate with you. And if you follow his stuff, usually they break down before it ever gets into court. They get worried because he puts enough in there, and he puts enough documentation that they blink first. And that's another one of these where he's getting results because they back off, because they don't want it. They don't want it. It's done so well, the steps he lays out. They're so sure that if they go to court, they're going to lose, and they would lose. You know what I mean? Because of the due process that he puts in under common law, you know, there's no doubt that they've defaulted. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I would follow that.
Okay.
I think he wanted us to write some kind of paperwork for him to get in the court, and you know, we've kind of already done that. I think if they look at the paperwork.
Well, you know, it's a paper that shouldn't be too difficult, but again, I got to go through all of the other paperwork to see what they've done to be able to incorporate a proper paper to begin with, and to make sure they cover all the points necessary for a notice and demand. And if they haven't, we need to make sure they get that inserted in there. And then we can write a paper for, a show cause. You know, the court should be able to entertain that because, again, you know, you're moving the court for the court to hear why a show cause shouldn't be taken. And the other side of the party's got to respond to that on why it shouldn't be taken. And then, of course, you can respond back to that if they do anything. But, you know, what they'll probably do is, I didn't mean it. You know, a lawyer will come in and play their lawyer games. But nevertheless, you make the application to push it forward. The next step, of course, is to sue directly and make the battle, take the battle into the court. But you should be able to get a default. Anyway, let's move on. Next question.
Okay. The next question is short. If the government does not adhere to work requests or grievances, and they continue to break the law, why can't we form vigilante committees?
Well, because that's not lawful.
Vigilance committees, it says.
What? What was that?
Vigilance committees, excuse me.
What's vigilance?
I'm not sure what that is.
That's like a public oversight group. They do that to police forces that are out of control. They put up that's kind of like what that guy there wanted us to do instead of the grand jury. What's his name? You remember he wanted us to do the public oversight thing, you know, which, you know, it makes you feel like you're doing something, but you really don't have any authority, you know.
Yeah, look, we need, this is what the grand jury is all about. This is what the trial jury is all about. This is what the court is all about. That's where you win these things. And look, people need to understand what we're doing here at National Liberty Alliance. We have been filing papers and doing lots of activities, and we've been doing informations. We've done indictments. We've sent out papers noticing people, you know, different judges and mortgage people, you know, companies or the tax collector who signs the paper for the non-judicial foreclosures and so on. And all this has been collective work, and we did a, you know, for a purpose. And we also, we filed so many papers in the federal courts. We even filed a lot of papers in the state courts too. And the whole thing was done for numerous reasons. Number one, to build a case and a background of a case, making our point. Number two, over the process of time, build a membership, okay? Because without the people behind you, we cannot be successful, okay? And all of this was done, and we've been for over 2 years now. We've been sending, before President Trump became president, we've been sending him things because, you know, we knew he was going to run for president. And during that process of time, we have been notifying him of what we're doing. Hopefully, we've been educating him. And I will tell you, I'm so surprised by some of the speeches. We have a new speech that, you know, people probably heard this. Maybe not many people have heard it. I don't know. But we posted it on our front page. If you go to our front page, welcome page, there are two speeches up here, and one is just a 30-second clip of one of them, and it's Mr. Trump addressing the General Assembly of the UN. And so it's a very short one, and we've mentioned this before. But recently, just a few days ago, I put up one, a Trump speech versus the New World Order. An extremely powerful speech, really lays out what he's doing and why he's doing it. And this is an early-on speech to begin with. And also, you know, this particular one, I think it's not long. It's only about 8 or 10 minutes. But it does lead in with, President Trump way back in the 80s being interviewed and given his position of certain things. And then it led into this speech he gave concerning the New World Order. And again, very powerful, very powerful. So he is clearly educated in quite a bit to the Constitution, more than I realized. And that, of course, is a good thing. And he understands that the people are sovereign, okay? And he has been elected to give power not to himself but to the people. That's what he said at the UN. That's pretty powerful. And we're going to use these quotes. We may use a lot of the quotes he did in this speech here, concerning, you know, the New World Order or the Deep State, which is part of the New World Order. Of course, it's the strong arm of the New World Order, the Deep State. And I'm trying to remember. I lost my train of thought. What was I responding to? Because I went all the way away from it. Jan?
The question was about vigilance committees.
Okay, getting back to that. All right. So the key thing here is really working with the grand jury and getting the administrators. If you do these committees, and I'm not sure what that word means, it almost sounds like vigilante, but maybe it's not. If it's a vigilante, you got to stay far away from that. But nevertheless, spending our time to build those committees is a task that's unbelievably difficult. And you'd have to create these committees in every single, you know, society, part of society, every town or village or whatever. And that's a huge, huge task, you know. I mean, New York State alone, we have something like 900 in some odd towns, and I forget, 62 or 63 cities in New York State alone. And I forget how many thousands across this nation. Well, the only way we're going to infiltrate and influence in that whole system is to, first of all, take control of the courts, take control of the federal courts so they apply the law of the land, and then we can hammer down on the state courts with their statutory courts, and that brings justice. But at the same time, while that's happening, we will then be re-energizing our focus towards the committeeman and show people how they can take over the committeeman process. And they've already got, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people across the nation already in those committees, many of them frustrated, many of them maybe just learning the process and haven't become frustrated yet. But a lot of them are frustrated, and then eventually they leave, but they got a high attrition rate, but they also got a strong influx of people coming in. So we can go in and capture that whole system, because we'd be going in there with the law of the land. We'd be going in there with power and authority. We'll teach people how to become elected committeemen and take control of the entire system and bring it back under the Constitution, under the law of the land, and get these people doing things that will benefit their society, that will educate the people of their society, that will get into the schools and also require people that are coming into office to be constitutionalists, to quiz them on the Constitution and send them away and home to get an education, send them out to National Liberty Alliance to get an education, and then come back and answer the questions concerning the Constitution and whatever job, you know, that they're going to be taking over, and, you know, what is their vow all about, you know, their oath, and so on and so forth. So we want statesmen, you know, and these people also, you know, over time, you know, you get enough people, enough influence across the state and across the nation, we don't have to worry about term limits, because we can apply term limits by not supporting them. Remember, you know, these people are answer to the committeeman. It's a powerful position. And the committeeman, or especially the chairman of the committee, makes a phone call to any of these elected officials within their election district. They're going to answer them quickly and respond and be obedient to anything that the chairman has to say, because that's where they get their power and authority, through the chairman and through those committees, committeemen, because they walk their papers, they support them. So, you know, again, this is where we take the power and the authority, and this can be done very quickly, very, very quickly. You know, once we gain the powers in the courts, within a year, we can gain the power of the committeemen across this nation. We can teach people, but again, you know, people need to be taught, they need to learn, they have to understand, they have to take a vow, and a vow to God, and they have to really be righteous, and we will lay out all of the necessary things and tools and everything they need, and also they can recreate the rules of the committee. We've already written them. They're very powerful, so you can execute what we have. You can make a few changes or whatever, but you have to stay on focus of what we're really trying to do, which is really empower the people and apply the power of the people against our government, but that where you have real true consent. Consent on the political realm, consent in the judicial realm. And if we don't control those two processes, we don't have liberty. They're controlling it for us, and we will find ourselves to be exactly what New York State says here, that the people of New York State, the citizens of New York State, are subjects of the state. I can't believe I read this in their stupid statutes, but that's what they say. And that's a serious problem. We need to change that attitude. You know, we, the people of the United States or of the states, are sovereign. That's what we are. And those people we are sending into power is to give the people more power, but not to take it, but to give it back to the people through service, just like President Trump says. So anyway, we really do have a great, great president. And people should watch that speech, that second video I put on the front page. And then after that video, reading right underneath it really applies what we already had up there. Okay, is that the last question?
Yes, that's all I have tonight, John.
All right. Okay, let's see where we go from here. I guess, Brent, you ready to take the mic for a while or what? You broke. Try it again.
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, so let me introduce Brent Winters. He's the author of the book, Excellence of the Common Law. You can visit his site, which is commonlawyer.com. And Brent's going to take the mic and speak on something, and then we'll move into an open forum. Gerard, you got control of the board?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Brent, go right ahead. You got
the mic. Thank you, gents. My comments are my alone and may or may not be the position of National Liberty Alliance. But as always, I am thankful that they're gracious enough to let me say a few things. We've been going through the Declaration of 76 each week. We got through it, and now we're in the Constitution of the United States. Just as we did with the Declaration of 76, clause by clause and blow by blow, we got down to Article 1, Clause 1, Section 1, Clause 1. Now we're at Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1. It says this: the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states. That phrase, several states, means several separate states of separate jurisdiction. Then it says, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. What they're saying here, what our Constitution is saying here, is that if you want to vote in a federal election, the qualification is whatever your state says it is for the most numerous branch of the state legislature. Every 2 years, the people of each state elect their representatives to Congress, that is, to the House of Representatives. And in order to vote in an election for the House of Representatives, a person must meet his state's qualifications to vote in an election for the most numerous branch of his state's legislature, usually called that state's House of Representatives. Most of the states have two independent branches of the legislature. There are three branches of government: the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And those three branches of government are as independent of each other as are the branches of a tree. The branches of a tree grow out of the trunk of the tree. The trunk of the tree, as it were, at common law, is the Constitution. Now, before we put our Constitution in place, our written Constitution, we had a Constitution. And that Constitution was our common law. And people in common law countries yet today call the common law their Constitution. Is the common law our Constitution? Yes, it is. Still, in fact, our Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. And it is, according to Article 6, the law of the land, which is the old phrase taken from Magna Carta that means our common law. It's just that we've put it in writing. I have friends in Australia, and they send me things, what they're trying to do in their own government, very much like our own, same problems, but with this twist. They talk about their constitution, and when they talk about their constitution, they're not talking about something in writing. They're talking about the way things are and the way things have been for centuries. That's fundamentally what they're talking about. And we can go back just like them, and we can trace our common law government back beyond Magna Carta by many centuries. It's just that Magna Carta stands as such a solid written stepping stone to hark back to. That's why Magna Carta gets so much attention, as does our Constitution of the United States. Well, it says here, Section 2, Clause 2, no person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen. Now notice closely, in order to run for Congress in any state in our country, you don't have to live in that state to run for Congress. But you do have to be an inhabitant. You have to live there by the time you get elected. I met a fellow when I was running for Congress in another life, when I was a political creature. I met a fellow who ran for Congress in 3 states in 1 year. You say, how did he do that? Well, he did it lawfully. He went to states that had their primaries at different times, and he ran the primaries. And if he'd lose in one state, he'd go to another one and run in that state. He was trying to find a state that would elect him. Is that okay? Yeah, that's okay. You don't have to live in the state you're running in, but you have to live there at the time, it says here, you are chosen. At the time of election day, you got to live there. And then, of course, it says you don't have to be a natural-born citizen to be a representative in the Congress of the United States. No, you could be a person from another country who has become what we call here naturalized. In other words, you go through the motions and the process that the law requires to become a citizen, as it is sometimes said, of the United States, or an American national, as some people probably better put it. But the word citizen is here used in our Constitution of the United States. Citizen of the United States, it says. Well, and 25 years of age. Let's go on to Section 2, Clause 3. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to the respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians, not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. This is complex because it includes not only, as folk would say at that time when it was written, not only white folk, but also black folk and red folk. And it tells what each of these, how much power is to be given according to the number of each of these. It says here, free persons. Now, some black men at that time were free persons. Some were not. Many were not. But many were. And also, there were persons bound to service for a term of years, as is called indentured service where you'd contract to an employer for a term of years. And then all red men, Indians, it says here, are not, excluding Indians, not taxed. But if Indians were taxed, then they were included in the number. This is complicated, and it's unnecessary. And if there's any flaw in our Constitution of the United States, this has got to be it. Maybe there's others, but this is the one that shouts at me. And I'll tell you why it shouts at me. Because God tells us clearly in his word that within a territorial boundary, there shall be one law for all people, period. And by the way, if there isn't, it won't work. It has never worked in the history of mankind, and the problem with which they were wrestling here was a problem that wasn't going to work. It won't work. It was tried in France. The Goths came down, sacked Rome in the 5th century, and then ate everything that wasn't nailed down, got bored, and left. About 250,000 of them, the Goths, G-O-T-H-S. Well, those were the Swedes. They were Swedes. That's what they were. 250,000 of them, men, women, and children, nobody knows why, got up, left, met the Roman legions at the border of the Roman Empire, decimated them in battle at the Battle of Andropol, went to Rome, sacked the place, left, and then they moved to Spain. And when they got to Spain, they stayed, and they mixed with the Spanish people. And for a few centuries, the Spaniards didn't know how to handle that. And so they had one court for the Goths, and another court for Spaniards. And then, of course, before long, they couldn't tell the Goths from the Spaniards. They all looked the same. Why? Well, they were mixing their blood by that time, because when you get folks together, that's what they inevitably do, and they couldn't tell them apart, and so they didn't know how to handle the problem, and then they started talking about, well, if you're so much blood, this much percentage of blood of a Goth, you're a Goth, and this much percentage of blood, it's the same ridiculous problem they're trying to, it's not, they think they've got to solve. They don't, over in what they call the state of Israel. What's a Jew? Well, they've changed the definition more times than you can count since they've been there. And we struggled with that problem here in the United States with, as it says here, the Indians. I know a fellow lives in Montana, I stay in close touch with, and he lives in a place where it's just a lot of Indians. And they now claim to own all the water in the state. Not to mention a whole lot of other things, and because they said we were here first, and now they're going to the federal court, and they're disregarding all the treaties they ever had with the white man. And this fellow told me what really upsets him about all of it, more than anything at this point, is that he's lived there all his life, and he said, I can't tell the difference between the red men and the white men, and the red women and the white women. We're so mixed up at this point, you can't even tell who's who. He said his brother married one of the gals from the tribe, and he said, I look at the little children, and some of them are like me, you're kind of redheaded, and the other ones are dark-headed, and I can't tell who's who, and it's worse when I go out in town. But yet, they're trying to hang on to the idea that we can have a different law and a different standard for different people. It will destroy the power of a country. How do I know? God said. He said it over and over and over again. It's a pattern. He was speaking of the nation of Israel, but it's a pattern to all men. It's a principle. He says there is one, Echad. That means a unity of law within a territorial boundary. I've given you this land. Don't try to apply one law to one person, another. It doesn't work that way. It will never work that way. If you're in, as it used to be said, when in Rome, do as the Romans. But if a person, for example, practices law in one state, I know this of lawyers, and he goes to another state, he must conform to their rules. There's one law within that state. And if we get to saying, well, we're going to have a different law for Islamic people, we're going to have a different law for American Indians, we're going to have a different law for whatever, it will destroy our power. It will destroy the efficiency of the engine. You can't have, just as an analogy, you have a V8 motor. If you have one law of physics for that motor and design that motor to according to those laws of physics, the motor will not sacrifice any power. It will run like a clock. But if it has unnecessary, if you try to foist an unnecessary principle into it, Well, I realize this is just an analogy. It's not the same thing, but still, it doesn't run. There must be one law, one government, by the way, and that is the unity. The unity of our country is not an attitude that says we're going to go make war on these people or those people. No, it's an attitude that says, here's the law. We are a nation not of men, but of laws, we've always said, and that's what distinguishes us. We do not change our standards because somebody doesn't like them or because they have a different law. No, when you come here, you abide by our law. And our law is our common law. We are a common law country. We have common law first principles. Our law schools and our courts are doing very much to try to obliterate those distinctions between us and the rest of the world. And if they do, our country will no longer have its distinctives. And it will no longer have the power it has presently. Well, we're in Section 2, Clause 3. I talked about unity of law. Let's talk a little bit about taxation. The foremost reason we have representatives in the Congress of the United States is for purposes of taxation. That's the driving force behind our particular organization of federal representation. Amendment 14, Section 2, modifies this Section 2, Clause 3, concerning representatives, now requiring only three things. Number one, the number of representatives allowed each state shall be based on its population. Number two, Congress must tally the people of the United States every 10 years. That's the census. Number three, each state must have at least one representative, even if there aren't enough people there to rate for representative in another state. For example, I remember when I was running for Congress, I knew exactly, I think it was 500-some thousand persons per representative. Now it's up to, somebody told me, over 700,000 because the population of our nation has grown so much just within the last 25 years. And if there's a state that doesn't have 700,000 people, because that's how many people, 700-some thousand, that's how many people a representative in Congress represents now in every other state. But if some state, take for example, Wyoming or Alaska, I don't believe those states have that many people. But they still, according to our Constitution, still get one representative in the House of Representatives in the Congress. Each state must have, the reference to other persons in the phrase three-fifths of all other persons refers to those at that time that were slaves, not indentured servants. Indentured servants are not slaves. Indentured servants are men under contract for a term of years or less, but they're under contract. They've agreed to work for another fellow for a certain period of time under a certain set of terms. Since our common law and our Constitution, by the way, forbids slavery, this part of our Constitution, this clause about three-fifths of all other persons, has no use anymore. The only reason that slavery existed in the United States was because common law didn't allow it, and it existed here because England said, their lawyers said, their parliament said, William Blackstone said in his commentaries that the common law does not apply in our American colonies. And if the common law doesn't apply in the American colonies, the king, King George III, is no longer king. He is emperor, and indeed that's what he called himself throughout the Empire of Britain. Slavery has never been allowed, never been lawful. It's happened, but it has never been lawful on the Isle or in the country of England. But it was allowed here, and that caused a terrible problem as to our common law, of course. But that's how that happened, and that was the inconsistency that caused all the trouble. Direct taxes are taxes one cannot avoid by shifting those taxes to another without forfeiting one's rights. So a direct tax is a tax the burden of which you cannot shift to another person. For instance, a sales tax on gasoline is not a direct tax. Why? Well, the fellow that sells the gas is responsible for paying the tax, but he shifts the burden of it to you when you buy gasoline at the pump. So that's called an indirect tax. Is a tax on you? You bet it is. Is it on the fellow selling gasoline to you? No. He just shifts it on over to you. You bear it. And because you bear it, it's called an indirect tax. Now, what's a direct tax? A direct tax would be, for example, a head tax. Our Constitution calls it a capitation tax, where the government would come along and say, and they used to do this before our country started, they'd say, every person in this colony must give the government $1 every year. Well, that could raise a substantial amount of money. That's called a direct tax. That's not allowed. Our Constitution in the United States says that the federal government, sitting in Washington, D.C., can't lawfully do that. Let's think about other kinds of taxes. A head tax on a living person is a direct tax. A tax for compensation for labor or services rendered. Our country always held to be a direct tax. A direct tax. Well, if it's a direct tax, it has to be apportioned according to population. That's the federal government. I'm not talking about the state governments. The Constitution says that taxes must be according, any tax the federal government burdens the country with, those taxes must be according to the population of each of the states. That's one way of putting it. If one state has 500,000 people and another state has 5 million people, well, then the tax burden to the state of 5 million, the Constitution says, this is a fundamental constitutional principle. The tax burden to the state of 5 million must be, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, well, 10 times greater. Now, somebody who knows arithmetic can tell me if I got that right. But the income tax, for example, puts a tax on a person according, let's say the federal government wants to raise $50 million or $50 billion. Well, it wouldn't be right to apportion $1 billion to each of the 50 states, because each of the 50 states, not all of them have the same number of people. That would be inequitable. That would be unfair. The income tax is a tax that is taxed directly upon the person. He can't shift it to somebody else. Well, how do I know? Well, he has to make a living. He's got to eat. His family's got to eat. He's got to work. So to tax his income or compensation for his labor or services rendered is a direct tax. And the fundamental constitutional principle is the federal government can't put a direct tax on a person without it being in a proportion to the population of his state. The way the income tax is done now, the population of the state has no bearing on the matter. And people say, well, the amendment to the Constitution that established the income tax changed all that. Well, that's the way it's been operating, but the courts have said otherwise, and they said that early on. I just wanted to mention those distinctions between direct tax and indirect tax. And if we keep going, Lord willing, we'll come to more detailed parts of the Constitution that will talk about that. Let me do one more clause here, at least get started. I'll read it, if nothing else, a long one. And Section 2, Clause 4. The actual enumeration, of which it spoke in the previous clause, shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of Congress, of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years, in such manner as they shall by law direct. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to choose 3, Massachusetts 8, Rhode Island and Providence plantations, 1 apiece, Connecticut 5, New York 6, New Jersey 4, Pennsylvania 8, that was a big state back then, Delaware 1, Maryland 6, Virginia 10, North Carolina 5, South Carolina 5, Georgia 3. That's all history by this time, of course. Nobody even knew where the West Coast was in those days, much less think about a state being out there. That was on another planet at that time. But it says here, 10 years, talking about in every subsequent term of 10 years, talking about the census or the enumeration that shall be made. And as law shall direct, and it says the number of representatives shall not exceed 1 for every 30,000. That is a big deal that's ignored. The number of representatives shall not exceed 1 for every 30,000 people. And now we're up to 1 for over 700,000. Now, why did they say shall not exceed 1 for every 30,000 people? Because they had learned, and there was much written about it at that time, that no representation of a man for other people in a legislative body was real, was meaningful, was genuine, could even have any real representative power if one man represented over 30,000 people. I knew a fellow out in California about 10 years ago. He got onto this, and he got onto it to such a degree that he did research and discovered that there's no lawful reason why this should have ever been changed. As a matter of fact, the number of people in the House of Representatives has now been fixed by law. I wonder, and of course it doesn't say in our Constitution who has the power to fix that number. It's fixed now, 435. Well, every year, of course, I'll just stop to consider it. When our country started, there were not much more than 3 million people here. Between 1800 and 1812, the census of 1810, I think there were about 12 million people here. And then by 1850, there were about 30 million people here. And then by 1900, there were 100 million people in the United States. And then about the time of General Eisenhower's presidency, there were about 150,000, maybe a little more. And then by our 200th anniversary, we were up to 200 million. That was in 1976. And now we're sporting over 300 million people. It's a lot of people. By the way, just to throw down a note here, and we'll end with this, but Abe Lincoln calculated what he believed would be the population of the United States about the time in which we live. And he figured there'd be about 300 million people here, maybe a little more. He wasn't far off. And he used actuarial tables and rates of birth, and he just used regular arithmetic to try to figure it out. Didn't have a calculator, just had a pencil and a piece of paper, figured that out. He did a pretty good job. And as long as our population keeps growing, we'll continue to be powerful. If it ever stops, our power will begin to wane. I must say, as I travel about the United States, and I've done a lot of traveling for the last 25 years, I am abundantly thankful that when I stop at night, I can usually find a pretty clean place to sleep for a pretty decent price. Not to mention all the food I can find to eat when I stop, and all the places I can find where they fix pretty good food. I'm just awful thankful that I live here. I realize there are a lot of problems, and I realize the evil empire has always been here, and that it moves on us apace now. We've never had a police state like we have now. So in many ways, the reason we do have nice things is because we have been vigilant. By the way, vigilant is just a Latin word that means awake just means to be awake. To be vigilant is to be awake. To do a vigil, you've heard of a vigil. A vigil is a time where you go someplace and you stay awake. You don't go to sleep. You watch and wait. The vigilante, as was pointed out a while ago, means the same thing, only it has taken on another meaning and refers to something that's now unlawful, which means holding court and lynching people, which is unlawful, of course, in our own country. Well, thank you again, John. And Gerard, I think you've got the board now, and back to you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brent. Okay. We got a couple people. We got a few minutes, so I'm going to take without delay here. I'm going to open up James from New Mexico. You're unmuted. Go ahead, James. Hello, James. You are unmuted. I don't hear any snoring. I got Felicia from Florida I can go to next. Okay, I'm going to go to Felicia.
Hey, how's everybody doing? Gerard, I got the message, and I'm going to send what I can this week when I get paid.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I'm sorry about what happened. It happened, though. But I'll do what I can to help. But I got a couple of questions for Brett. Is he still on the line?
He's there. Go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. Brett, I'm listening, and I just got a question when you was talking about the red men and the other races. Does common law actually apply? Not just common law, but the Constitution, does it actually apply to those groups? Because I know from research and history that they actually, the Indians was actually labeled as Negroids before the race mixing started.
Uh-huh. No, I read those things too. The red man was offered citizenship early on in a lot of places, what was called state citizenship, and then federal national to be an American national. And then also, during the administration of Warren Harding, he pushed legislation through Congress making all... Now, somebody can check up on this because I don't feel sure about what I'm about to say, but I know I'm close. I think the way the legislation read, that all American Indians are citizens of the United States unless they choose not to be. They've got to say, no, I don't want to be. But he was the one that pushed that through. Quite a man. He was made fun of throughout his presidency, and our history books don't give him much shrift, but he was a crackerjack of a fella and understood things and acted accordingly. He didn't say much. He didn't make a big hullabaloo about anything, but he's the one that pushed that through. Now, of course, our common law applies. It is true law, and it is a way of life, not a list of laws, and it applies to all men at all times and all places. And as Justice Story said, our Constitution of the United States, which is a brief common law government, it applies, and it's even its Bill of Rights, apply wherever the United States government chooses to act, whether within the territorial boundaries of the United States or at Gitmo Bay down in Cuba or in Afghanistan. No matter where they act, every person that is brought under the power of the United States for whatever reason is entitled to the protections of our Constitution. That was the view that Justice Story took, the man that served longer than any other justice on the Supreme Court, and the man that wrote the commentaries that were so powerful on our Constitution in the United States about 40 years after our Constitution was put in place. And so our common law, yes, of course, it applies. It is the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things. William Blackstone talks much about it, and it will hurt us if we say that there is some other law that applies to people because of a different nationality, a different genealogy, a different appearance, a different anything. men any man that is where, or woman that is where, the United States chooses to act is entitled to the protections of the common law. But even if not in our own country, the common law should apply everywhere in the world. It doesn't. The law of the city applies in almost every country of the world, the Code of Justinian, or the principles of it, even if the code is not explicitly cited. So, that's the answer to the question. Of course it applies.
Okay. And also, Mr. John, how's the default on Judge Kahn coming?
Yeah, well, we sent him to default, but I don't know what the next step that we're planning on moving. John's been discussing, what movements we can make there.
There's not much we could really do until we move into this next court case where we will bring that in, and then we'll be doing more. Bringing the grand jury together for indictments. So we'll be doing more considerations of indictments as we move through the court cases, because we know we're going to get a lot of interference. People are going to try to interfere in this court case. So, but we will try to use this court case as an execution point for the others. And again, we're operating in this case, this new case. We're coming in. It's an extraordinary, thing that we're doing. And we're going to be coming in as a prosecutor for the people. The grand jury is going to come in as the prosecutor, because the prosecutors aren't doing their jobs to do the proper prosecuting. I mean, goodness.
Right.
The
more I learn, it's just we're living in a land of criminals.
Absolutely. It's worse than, I remember when I was younger, they used to talk about all the problems in Mexico, which are still down there. But they do have a problem. All the people have a problem when they're approached by the police themselves. They, intimidate them and then steal money off them in order to keep their freedom. And that's pretty bad. But nevertheless, on the top end, we're probably much more corrupt than they are. We're probably the most, all these nations have the same problem. The deep state is really entrenched everywhere. But I think the most deepest is in the United States. I mean, there's a war going on to get these people out of power. And we may even see some serious, serious problems coming about. The deep state has control over 3 nuclear bombs. That they achieved during the Obama administration, but what'd you say?
There will be no nuclear bombs going off.
Well, we don't know that. We don't know that.
I know
they
that.
EMPs. Well, how do you know that?
Well, they do that every day with the Elf Tower. They do the EMP thing every day with the Elf Towers and all this, technology they have. They do that. So I noticed that there is these towers, they're next to the jails, they're next to the prisons, they're next to the schools, they're at the ballparks, they're pretty much controlling everybody's thinking process.
Yeah, but these people are desperate, okay? They are in a desperate situation because they're about to be revealed to the world who and what they are and the evils that they have done. And they never anticipated with all the evils they've done and the way they acted, as they were above the law, they'd never be caught. They never anticipated a Trump becoming the president. Because look at, this is the perfect guy to be the president of the United States at this point in time, the perfect man. And,
I heard he was put there. I mean, even the Simpsons predicted it years beforehand, so.
Well, look at, there was an easy prediction, really. Anybody who's followed Trump, it was kind of an easy prediction that he's probably going to run for president in his older age because of his attitude and his statements. I mean, if you follow all of the interviews he's had since the 80s when he was a very young man and followed it through, you could see he really wanted to do something, it wasn't until now that he achieved the knowledge, the ability, the wisdom. Wisdom comes with age, and everything has come to him at the right time. I think his opportunity potentially of becoming born again and having a true relationship with Christ is more now than ever. I think becoming president has really changed him. There's no doubt it has to. And changed him more closer to the Lord than ever. So there's so many good opportunities there. Then also, you know, working with the military intelligence, the military who has military intelligence, which oversees all intelligence. So anything the CIA's got, the FBI's got, the NSA, it doesn't matter. The military intelligence has access to all of that also. But it is a fact. It is a fact that the deep state has in control of three weapons, you know, three atomic bombs. They could be doing, what do they call it, EMPs when they blow them up in the air or something? They've had control of missiles. Of course, you know, they don't have, they got access to it, I guess. And I know that they did put off a missile a while back and it was intercepted. They're desperate people right now because they know their time has come. It's like the devil. He knows his hour has come. And who knows what's going to happen, but they're going to pull something off. They have to pull something off.
They're going to be dismantled. I can tell you that now. I know that for a fact.
Well, they're not going to win. Okay,
no.
They're not going to win. Okay, but that doesn't mean that they won't blow off an atomic bomb. And who knows what kind of, how they're going to control that narrative is another thing, number one, because they still have control of the major media. So it's an uphill battle. It really, really is. We're playing our role, our part in the courts, but we'll see what happens on the other side of things.
Hey, I just want to round off what you said, John, about, you know, what Trump is doing and the time. Look, as bad as it is in America, we're still the freest one. We still have our guns. We still have more freedom than almost every country in the world. The whole world's watching us. They're looking to us for this because, you know, we're the only ones that really have a chance on putting these central bankers down, and that's what it's about. And these evil cabalists, you know, these demonic people that worship the devil, and they do, and they're cannibals and they eat people. And their reign is at an end here because they've scratched the eyeball of God, I believe. So I think there's great things to come. Now, Donald Trump was talking to the military, and one of the things that they waited for is they know that this fiat money system that they put in place, every 50 years it goes bankrupt, and every 50 years they sell us a new baloney to bring us down the road even poorer. So when Nixon took us off the gold, the silver, right? So they knew that this thing was going to run until about now, and they wanted him in there so that when it went bad, he's going to now, you know, they would like to blame it on him, but he's going to blame it on the Federal Reserve. He's going to attempt to take out the Federal Reserve. That's a dangerous game because that's what got Kennedy killed. That's what got a lot of people killed when you come up against that. So this is a serious battle. And the other thing I wanted to say is, you know, this David Merlin put a case in, a criminal case to the FBI. He did much the same like we did, and he did it before we did it. He did it back in the 2000s. He sent it to the Department of Justice, the President, the Congress, blah, blah, blah. The case is still open. They never answered it. You can join his case. If he has a board, like let's say the IRS comes after you, you send your case into his board. They look at your case, and they look at, you know, what they're saying, and then you can enjoinder his case that's still up there that they haven't answered in 24 years. It's been 24 years it's been open. When Donald Trump came into the presidency, he resent it to Donald Trump and the Congress and everybody else. And that's kind of like what he did. He did a mirror image of kind of what we did. And I think that's a great idea that we put these criminal cases in against them, you know, and look at, they're feeling the pressure. You know, we think we're the only ones doing it. Here he is. He has a criminal case that they can't answer. And people that enjoin his case, a lot of times when you send that paperwork in, the IRS drops the charges. It's something that we should look into and maybe even team up with him, because I think that he's kind of cracked the code on their statutes. that the income tax wasn't really written for American citizens, and number two, is they're misapplying the code, the statute. They're using regulations, and they take away your biggest deduction is your income, is your work is your deduction, your cost. Your cost is your labor. And they can't say your gross income is your salary, because that takes away the deduction of your labor. So if you deduct the labor that it took to get your salary, guess what? You don't owe any income tax, do you? Because it costs you that in fair market value. So it doesn't apply. It doesn't apply to the average citizen. It only applies to money that's made through corporate, like dividends and that type of income they can legally tax from corporations. But for the average person, like Brent explained, if they want to do a head tax, it has to be equal. Well, it's not. It's a graduated tax. It's unconstitutional. And he's called them on all that stuff and put a case in to the Congress and the Department, and it's actually filed with the FBI. Well, we know what the FBI is all about, James Comey and all that. That's why they haven't answered it in 24 years, because they can't. And that's why they're not answering us, because they can't. Look, this is the end of the line, whether you know it or not, folks. This is it. Everybody's pushing, and it's all this pimple has come to a head, and it's getting ready to burst. And look, we could have some hard times when it bursts, but I think we're going to do better than the rest of the world. I think that, you know, if we stick together and we barter with each other and we don't lose our heads, I think Donald Trump has a plan on taking the money that they've stolen and bring it back into the country. But I still think you're going to end up maybe with a few months of civil unrest and high inflation. So we have to get through that. So, you know, you should be saving some money and saving some and stocking up some food. And my goodness,
I'm just trying to survive.
That's all we're anybody to do. But look, at the way you're going to survive is by, it's not about what's in your bank account. It's about what's in your heart. You have lots of friends and neighbors. Yeah. You got to network with people. People got to help people. That's the only way we're going to get through this. And I think it's happening. I think it's happening this winter. So that's my feeling. I don't see how much further they can push this out after these midterm elections. We'll see. It's going to be very interesting, to say the least. And hopefully, these people like Judge Kahn, I think they're getting very worried now. So we might have a surprise ending. You know what I mean? We might have.
We're
a
locking
good
a lot of people up now. So they're locking a lot of those guys up.
Yeah. Yes, they are. Yep. And that's just the beginning. So, you know, because there's so much information available, look at the tables, all their methodologies have been turned against them. If, you know, and that's what God does. He uses the devil's method against him. He leads him around like a bull by the nose, you know. And they took all the bait, these people, because they're ignorant and they're stupid in a lot of ways. Because they're angry and their heart is hardened and they're doing evil things and they can't see the forest for the trees, and it's going to be their own demise. And so all that information that they were collecting, they never thought it would be used against them. Guess what? What he doesn't have them, whatever they can't prove on treason, they can prove on these abuses, on these child trafficking and all this other abuses. They're going down one way or the other or both. And, of course, that's going to create a problem when we lose half the Congress or three-quarters of the Congress and the Senate, because they're all leaving. They're all resigning. They're not running for re-election, and that's why. So we'll see what happens.
Well, someone happened to the Catholic Church, and the priests and the nuns were arrested for doing this to the children for all these years. And I was like, I tried to tell you guys.
Yeah, there's been a lot of stuff going on in a lot of places. You know, it was just never made public, and the Catholic Church was very good at hiding it. You know, they were the worst as far as being able to control the narrative, kind of like controlling the media, like CNN and CBS do. But anyway, look at those days. Those days are numbered. They're at their end, and they're not going to get away with it anymore. Thank God for that. You know, amen, amen.
And we the people are going to rise, and God bless us and bless you and everybody here, because it's only by our efforts that we're going to come through this. Anyway, we're after 12, so we need to end.
And okay, thank you very much for your time.
And I want to thank everybody who's contributed to my problem, and I certainly, you know, enjoy what has happened and would do the same for you guys. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you. Good night.